Tonight on The Download, from The Daily Line, A.D. Quigg, Heather Sharone, and Ray Hodge. Chicago actor Philip Earl Johnson, and another episode of The Swap Meet with Greg Flamm. Now, here's your host, a man who is still wearing his I Voted bracelet, Justin Kaufman.
And worse, I just keep Instagramming it. I just put new pictures up. It's going to be 3-4 days later, I'm going to be like, I voted all over your Twitter. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Woo, man. I don't know if you had a chance to catch a primary night, but there was an election yesterday. I don't know if you noticed it. If you listened with us, we were on the stream. The Blackhawks were on 720, but we did WGNradio.com. Didn't realize this when we were doing it, but when you do the stream, there's no commercials. And so we worked it out. I think Pete and I were talking about it. It was like 3 hours and 55 minutes of talking. Usually when you do a four-hour show, especially like tonight, we'll do a four-hour, there'll be a lot of content. There's a lot of stuff to do tonight. We have an awesome show lined up. But there's breaks. You know, you have a 2-3 minute break here. You have a cast. Rob does newscasts. And so you have a little bit of time. So when you're done, it's really like about almost two and a half hours worth of stuff. Last night, there were no... Rob did some tally, some election stuff. But there were no commercials. He just went through. I had a ton of people in here. We kept rotating panels. We had all the candidates call in. I was hoarse by the end of it. You can hear it a little bit. That was a long show. I felt at the end, I was like, 4 hours talking. I felt like that guy at the party that's like, you know, I just watched the Jeffrey Bear piece on the Chicago River, and let me tell you everything I know about the Chicago River.
Yeah. It was long.
It was, but it was worth it. It was fun.
And then every once in a while, we play Yakety Sax and shuffle the crew, and then right back at it.
Yeah, it was good. I'm looking for tonight. We got a great show lined up. But coming up, the women from The Daily Line will be here. Heather Sharone, A.D. Quigg, and Ray Hodge is going to call in from Springfield. And we'll properly sum up what happened yesterday with the primary election. What were the storylines and how did they play out? And what does it do to tee up elections here in the state of Illinois for November? Lots to talk about in that regard, not just in the state of Illinois, but the county of Cook. And also, I would say a little bit in the county of DuPage. At some point or another, you know, there will be questions about what happened with the glitch out there. They glitches with their election machines. But also the Cook County Board of Elections and the dust-up around Andrea Rayless signs that were up at the election polling places that John Williams has been talking about. So there's a lot still to see the primary election as a trial run. For the real deal in general, we got a lot of work to do. So that's something we'll talk to the reporters about as well.
I had a weird election thing happen to me today, in fact.
What?
I went to early vote on Sunday at the Edgewater Library. I live in Edgewater. And I voted and went to this, you know, hand in my my little card for the, yeah, you know, electronic voting, and the guy... somewhat, you know, not really into it, he tossed me my wristband. You know, didn't put it on me.
He didn't apply it.
No, he didn't apply it. He just kind of like handed it to me, and then he made a joke that I was wearing shorts. I just come from the gym. Don't, no judgment here.
Hey, I know you're a judge, but no judgment.
Right. And then right before work this afternoon, I was at the Gap right down here on Michigan Avenue. Saw him.
Oh, hey, did he remember you?
We made eye contact.
No.
Like, yeah, like.
He's like, yeah, hey, shorts.
Yeah.
You're buying pants?
I was buying pants.
He's like, I told you, it's too early for shorts. He followed you. That's amazing. What a story, Pete. That's awesome. All right, so we'll talk about the primary election. Also tonight, actor Philip Earl Johnson. He's in An Enemy of the People, Bob Falls production at the Goodman Theater. We'll talk about not only his career in acting here in Chicago, but also his career as a street performance. He does a character called Mooney at the Renaissance Fairs. And it is silent comedy. It's not clowning, you know, like Baskets, Zach Galifianakis, but And it's a very old tradition, a European street performance tradition. We'll talk with Philip about that. Also tonight, as I mentioned in the crosstalk, Keith Haring, the mural, the Chicago mural that used to be at Grant Park, is now on display at the Cultural Center. And some of the kids from 1989 that helped paint that mural are going to be in studio tonight to talk about that experience. Both are now professional artists. How about that? So that will also be tonight. And, of course, it's Wednesday night, so the swap meet, Greg Flamm, is in the building. Well, not yet, but it'd be awesome if Greg got here at 7, hung out for 3 hours, just waiting out there with a huge poster of Mike Ditka or whatever he's got this week. 312-981-7200, the best Chicago brag. Chicago memorabilia brag will get you a pizza tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I am Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back, and we will get to the carryout, so stay with us. It's The Download here at 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman, let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. Well, it's Pritzker versus Rauner. The election promises all the excitement of a charity black tie gala, except a cash bar. These rich guys never go open bar, do they? It's always cash bar. Actually, Twitter was saying the food last night at Pritzker's party was super expensive. Like $10 sandwiches. Who do you think you are? Panera? Is Panera running for something? He's probably running for something, too. Can't these guys do a Mortimer and Randolph and just spend a dollar on this social experiment called the gubernatorial election and donate the rest to balancing the Illinois budget? Because they can't outspend each other. Am I the only one that's seen War Games? The only way to win is to not play. These uber-rich candidates will take on kitchen table issues, which would be my first debate question. What does a kitchen table look like?
Yeah, that's great. I haven't been down to the servants' quarters in,
The race for governor will be interesting, and there's a lot to unpack as the two candidates will have to rely on their messaging more than their money. We'll have plenty of time to get to the issues and the nonstop billionaire bits. I promise you that. The AG race, State Senator Kwame Raoul beat Pat Quinn. Could this be the last of Pat Quinn? Maybe. But have no fear, he may be available to mow lawns this summer. Who doesn't have the best manual lawn mower on the block? And this dude is... I can't get enough. He'll never be able to live down that commercial of him out in front of his house mowing his lawn with a manual lawnmower. Like somehow, somewhere in there, they were like, you know what? Get rid of the automatic. Go manual. Take us back. Show us you're a guy from the 30s. Love that commercial. The Republicans go with Erica Harold, who is Miss America and a Harvard grad, which... I don't know, what does she put down for extra skills on her resume? Play guitar? What does it matter where she went to college? Everyone always says that, right? Seems weird to keep saying that. Yeah. Kwame Raoul versus Erica Harold. Two candidates with four first names. Yeah. Cool. The Cook County Assessor's Office, Fritz Kagi, beat incumbent Joe Berrios in the upset that really wasn't an upset. It started a chorus of questions today like, is the Cook County Democratic machine dead? Maybe the question should be, why do we think that the Cook County Democratic machine could overcome the fact that Berrios has had the worst 3 months in the history of politics? Seriously, if he did overcome and win this election, we'd all be like, what a scam. The machine did it again. But he loses and we're like, have they lost their ability to scam? What do you want? What else in Cook County? Preckwinkle won, but John Fritchie and Richard Boykin are out as Cook County commissioners. Gee, we thought the soda tax fallout would be all about Tony Taxwinkle. Love that. Taxwinkle. But two of the commissioners in favor of the repeal are gone instead. And you said that the Cook County Democrat machine was dead. Referenda items. Cook County voters said yes to the non-binding, non-crucial, non-gonna-happen legalization of marijuana. They put that question on the ballot and others, so they didn't have to put elected school board or constitutional convention on there instead. You like, the questions are so simple. Do you like healthcare? Aren't opioids terrible? A train going 60 miles per hour arrives at the station at 3 p.m. Show your math. Those are the four questions. We'll talk much more about the election on our panel coming up here right after the news. Other stories happening around today. Everybody hates Facebook now? Is that a thing? Really? Ever since the news came out that political consultants had illegally... question mark? Obtain how many times we skipped the like button for the love or the wow button? Users are saying enough's enough and the stock is dropping. Somehow this is associated to Trump, but don't be faked by this news. When Democrats do the same thing, they're progressive and using social media in a cool way. Republicans do it, and everyone's like, I need to take a shower right now. Also, can we take a step back and realize that perhaps we are the problem here? Stop liking everything, right? Maybe throw off the political consultants a bit. Like that death metal page and Amy Grant, you know? Maybe a Mike Huckabee page and Elizabeth Warren. Peanut butter and jelly. And then like the download page. That'll show them. The Fed raised the key interest rate today, saying that the economy is getting stronger, so it's time to jack up the rates. And they may do it two more times this year, maybe three times next year. Before we know it, the interest rate's going to be all Jimmy Carter up in here. You want 27% on this loan? You got it. Sounds like a steal. So the economy. I am such a layman when it comes to the economy. I'm like, hey, it's going well, so jack up the rates on your credit card. That's good. It's a good thing. Right. In weather, oh, wait, I got one before that. Amazon's in town to survey the possibility of a second headquarters here. The governor was on Roe and Anna today, and he said that the plan to woo them was confidential. Oh, okay. Please don't take them to Navy Pier, right? Please? You could take them there once, but don't take them twice. Nobody goes twice. Please. You bring your aunt and uncle to Navy Pier once. Don't do it twice. Also, if I find out that the guys who played the Blues Brothers, the impression of Blues Brother, if they're involved in this wooing of Amazon, now you're all out. You all have to move to Nashville. In weather, is today the first day of spring? Was yesterday? Man, have we gotten wise to the official beginning of spring or what? Nobody even mentions it anymore because we know the first real day of spring is Cinco de Mayo. That's when the weather changes. In sports, the Loyola Ramblers were stranded at the airport in Atlanta. What? Unacceptable. I put this squarely on Sister Jean. She should be coordinating limos, arguing with police escorts, threatening the wrath of God on Uber X drivers in the Atlanta area. What do you mean they're stranded? Show some respect, NCAA. We are single-handedly giving you the feel-good storyline of your boring March Madness tournament. And this is how you thank the Ramblers? You don't pick them up at the airport? I'll bet Kentucky flew private jet right to the hotel. They just skipped the airport, landed right on the top of the Marquis Marriott, whatever it was. It's ridiculous. Hey, chip on shoulder, Loyola. They don't pick you up from the airport, you go to the Final Four. Boom. The mayor made a donut bet with the mayor of Reno today. What? I guess that's the home of the University of Nevada. The Ramblers, that's the Ramblers' opponent tomorrow night. Donuts. Come on. It's Loyola. It's Rogers Park. Should have been a Satan burger from Heartland Cafe. Or a 10-minute shopping spree from that Coconuts on Sheridan. Oh, that's not there anymore? Yeah. Are they just stealing the city's soul? How can we be a city without a Coconuts? Also, donuts? Those donuts better have Italian beef on them. That's all I'm saying, right? Sox and Cubs are about to break camp this weekend, ready for the opener, which is, what, in 10 days or so? The Sox seem to be set on having Yoan Moncada lead off. Usually not a leadoff hitter, but let's see if he can go all George Springer on the league, huh? Jose Abreu got hurt yesterday, slightly pulled hammy. Also, Nicky Delmonico a little banged up. And Matt Davidson has hit his way into the starting third baseman job. I like that. James Shield is the opening day starter for the club. I like that a little less. But sounds good. The Cubs, the only question is where they're going to fit everyone at the start of the year. Happ is playing lights out, but not sure if he starts over Albert Elmora in center or over Baez at second. Also, Brandon Morrow, is he the closer? What's happening there? Is he the closer? I'm not even sure who would be the closer if it's not him, so we'll find out. The Bulls did what they had to do last night, lost to the Knicks. Good work. Stay on target. More Zipser, less Markkanen for the rest of this miserable season. If you are not the worst five by the end of the season, what was this septic tank season for anyway? If you come back to us as Chicago fans, hey, we secured the 9th pick. No, not acceptable. Also, the Blackhawks were officially eliminated from playoff contention last night. And to add insult to injury, the Nashville Predators are the best team in the NHL. Going to be a stingy Stanley Cup playoffs this year, Blackhawks fan. Very stingy. Ouch. And finally tonight, the Lollapalooza lineup is out, and Bruno Mars is the headliner. He'll join Jack White, The Weeknd, Arctic Monkeys, Vampire Weekend, and LL Cool J. LL Cool J from NCIS is going to be on stage at Lollapalooza? Odd choice. Who's next? The guy from CSI? No, I don't buy it. It's a music festival, guys. LL Cool J. He's got cool hats. That's the carryout for March 21st. Hey, we're not sure if today's the first day of spring, but if it is, well, nothing changes. We still have stew. All right, coming up, we'll get into our primary coverage from the Daily Line. AD Quigg, Heather Sharon, and Ray Hodge are going to join us. That's the download tonight. Stay with us. Rob Martier, good to see you again, bud.
Oh, so good, so good. What a great night last night on the stream.
Last night, I have to say, when I left here, there was a full, cold, albeit cold, veggie pizza still down here. Yeah.
Boy, surprised that the veggie pizza was still left.
Yeah, Chris Roebling was complaining there wasn't a gluten-free pizza because he's a gluten-free kind of guy. And I was like, you know what, deal with it. Sorry.
Well, I'm going to take away his Republican card now.
Yeah.
It's uncalled for.
Yeah. It was a fun night, man. That was a blast.
It was.
Always good to do election night with you, bud.
It is fun, and I criticize myself maybe a bit too much just because of the repetition, but that's what it's all about. I mean, you're going through the numbers over and over again, so.
Yeah, but there's something great about radio in that regard is that there's still that anticipation. You know, you can at 15, it could be the same story coming up at 30, but just a slight change is I like it. I like this anticipation to the cast.
So. Yeah, it was good stuff.
Rob, it's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, last night was a tremendous night if you're a political junkie. If not, it just preempted 2.5 Men for the reruns. 10:30, right? But we have a lot to talk about what happened last night and what it means for the future of the state of Illinois. In studio tonight, as every Wednesday, we have a supersized segment tonight.
Yes.
AD Quigg and Heather Sharon, both from the Daily Line here in Chicago, covers everything city, county, and state when it comes to politics. Good to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Also joining us on the line, Ray Hodge. He covers Springfield for the Daily Line. Ray, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
All right, so there's so much to unpack from what happened last night, and you guys were all covering this as well, but what was the takeaway? What is the storyline that you took away from the primary? Let's start with you, AD.
Machine. There's a lot of machine talk. Donald Trump was a boogeyman, but even bigger in Illinois, I think Mike Madigan was a boogeyman. Ed Burke was a bit of a boogeyman, and Joe Barrios was definitely a boogeyman.
And so Dan Lipinski.
There's a lot of, like, tying people to machine politicians, and a lot of those were successful.
There you go. Okay, what do you got, Heather?
It's sort of the last act of the big debate over the soda tax. Or, I'm sorry, I'm a native of Chicago, and I should say pop tax.
Yeah, the pop tax.
Beverage tax is beverage what President tax. Preckwinkle would like you to say.
So everybody told me that, you know, Toni Preckwinkle had shot herself in her foot, her political career was over, she was done for, and she coasted to a relatively easy victory over former alderman Bob Fioretti. And it looks like Richard Boykin, who led the fight against the pop tax, is going to lose his seat to Brandon Johnson, a Chicago's teacher union organizer. And John Fritchie, who was also out there against it, is no longer going to be a commissioner, which I think is a stunning reversal from where we were.
What does that mean?
6 months ago.
I know we'll get into this tonight, but we were talking about that last night as you kind of put connect the dots there. When we talk about the death of the Cook County machine with Joe Barrios, but it seems like the Cook County Democrat machine came out to defeat or at least not support some of the people that were the opponents of the soda tax. It seemed like Toni Preckwinkle was A-OK, but these guys were left out on an island.
I think Toni Preckwinkle was okay because her challenger in Bob Fioretti was not the perfect candidate, and because the beverage tax had been repealed, he didn't have a ton to run on. As for Fritchie and Boykin, because they were so loud and so anti-revenue, it was less machine and more union backing that came to these challengers.
Okay. I mean, different machine, right?
Different machine, but very, very powerful in the series of races. SEIU, CTU, AFSCME all kind of came out and said, all right, we need to get rid of Boykin and Fritchie because we want to protect our county workers' jobs.
Interesting, because when you repeal that soda tax, beverage tax, pop tax, whatever you want to call it, what happened from that were cuts. I mean, budget cuts and jobs, and that seemed to come back and nip those guys in the butt.
It did. And the other thing that I think last night proved is the enduring power of the teachers union as a political force in Cook County and Chicago. And I think that's been a little bit in question because, of course, Karen Lewis is still recovering from a stroke. So she hasn't been sort of out there, you know, pushing for candidates, that sort of thing. But the teachers union made their, you know, clout very clear last night, getting Johnson onto the county board and sort of, you know, working to help elect Chewy Garcia to Congress, who, of course, let's not forget, they plucked really from obscurity. Sure, he was a county commissioner, he'd been an alderman, but they sort of made him a household name with that mustache, you know, that everybody can see right away, you know, to, you know, elevate him to Congress with the surprise retirement of Luis Gutierrez.
Ray, I want to bring you in as well, and I want to get to Pritzker and Rauner because that's the big ticket. But before we do, let's stay there because the progressive, if you look on paper and you look at across the board, and especially if you look at the Pritzker and Rauner, or at least the Pritzker run or race, the progressive vote wasn't there for Dan Biss. It wasn't there for Chris Kennedy. J.B. Pritzker wins. So on first take, you say, well, maybe there wasn't really a push for progressive Democrats in the state. But when you start looking at what happened to Dan Burke, what happened to Joe Berrios, what happened to some of the things you just mentioned, you start to see, and reading today, that the progressive wing of the Democrats in Cook County, they're starting to pile up at least some substantial wins, if not lower level wins, to think about the future.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Justin. The momentum is there on the progressive side. And, you know, one of the things that we saw from last night was that really got magnified given the enormous amount of turnout that Democrats managed to pull in. And in terms of, you know, just how progressives are relating in their victories or losses from last night to, you know, machine politics, it's really interesting to look at it also through the lens of the Lipinski-Newman race, right? Because you've got a real setback for progressives there, but it was by a very, very narrow margin. Of course, Politico's Natasha Kurecki notes very correctly there that the Susan B. Anthony Association, which is an anti-abortion rights group, was kind of a 11th-hour push to really help get Lipinski across the line. But what is probably a little bit less talked about is the fact that Lipinski is, you know, he's very much a part of that you know, its own machine. And that machine is there, and it's been very well rooted, and it was very well mobilized to get him across the finish line. And so you're starting to see a little bit of conflict between, you know, the emerging progressive versus the, you know, the embedded sort of old way of doing things, the old machines. And speaking of machines, you know, you've still got a pretty solid showing for House Speaker Michael Madigan, who was, you know, he was a face that became contentious in a lot of races. It became sort of a litmus test in many ways between progressive voices and traditional establishment Democrats, but he swept. You know, there wasn't, as far as what we can find right now, we didn't see a whole lot of pushback against candidates of his choosing. We saw a lot of victories, you know, sweeping across the House races. Everywhere that he put his handprint of support on someone, they tended to come quite across the line. So, I mean, you saw on the state level, as well as on the governor's race level, and as well as on the congressional level, a real, you know, just to kind of affirm what, you know, AD and Heather are talking about there, you do see that machine and several machines are still running. They're humming smoothly.
Let's do this. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and then let's get into Pritzker-Rauner, what today is being said by both parties when it comes to unity, healing the wounds of a very contentious primary race. We are talking about last night's election with Ray Hodge, who's in Springfield, AD Quigg, and Heather Sharone in studio, all with the Daily Line, which covers all the city, state, and county races for that in that site. All right, we'll take a quick break. Stay with us. Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. Ray Hodge is on the line. AD Quigg and Heather Sharone are in studio in our showcase studio right here on Michigan Avenue. Talking about last night's primary results. Ray, why don't we start with you here? Of course, the race is set for governor with the incumbent Bruce Rauner versus J.B. Pritzker. I'm interested in the calls and the tone and the tenor in Springfield around unity. We've had a lot of talk about that word in the last 24 hours. What can you tell us about how both parties are viewing what happened in the primary and what needs to happen now?
Well, you know, I think it's probably most helpful to kind of focus in on the Republican side of things, right? Because pretty much everyone, either in Springfield or in Chicago, no one could have predicted, and I think no one expected, you know, Republican challenger Jeannie Ives, a member of the House of Representatives from Wheaton with very strong far-right views, to get so close to, you know, incumbent Governor Bruce Rauner, right? No one really expected something as close as a 4-point margin to separate the two. And what that really shows is that, you know, there's a long-term lingering effect from that bill that we saw over the summer that really caused a pretty heavy social conservative divide in the Republican Party, right? So we saw HB 40, which was the abortion bill that drew a lot of controversy. And right then, if there hadn't been as big a split as there was before, which there already was, but if there hadn't been as big a split as before for Republicans in Illinois state government, then that was surely the moment to do it. One of the leading voices calling on, you know, on Rauner to be chastised and sort of, you know, railing against this was, you know, House Republican Peter Breen, a social conservative out of Lombard. Breen has in the past, you know, allied himself with other social conservatives. He was one of those group of voices that was very in support of Representative Jeannie Ives in her bid during this time. And that really represented the partisan split that I think that, you know, the governor was speaking to last night during his acceptance speech. Yeah. And he's calling on the party to rally together. You know, last week or two, we saw some gun legislation issues where it was kind of clear that Governor Bruce Rauner was looking for a way to bring that conservative base back in, right? Tamping down on some gun reform issues, making some more additional bids towards that side of the party. But at the end of the day, you know, that split was still really strong. But today is a new day. In fact, Representative Peter Breen, the same social conservative that went out on a limb to sort of chastise Rauner, was, you know, speaking in a release, and, you know, he was speaking today about the necessity to come together, saying, I support him 100%. And furthermore, saying, you know, the Madigan machine has to be stopped, and calling J.B. Pritzker a rubber stamp. So I think it's a matter of priorities at this point. And when someone like Peter Breen is, you know, as conservative as he is, starts backing Rauner, I think that that's a step forward to seeing, you know, Rauner's call from last night for unity really answered for Republicans.
Okay, Heather, AD, quickly, just on the Democrat side, does there need to be any unity? I mean, J.B. Pritzker wins, but they got contentious in there as well, especially with Daniel Biss.
They all came together very quickly last night to say we might disagree on sort of the details of the issues, but they, you know, sort of were singing from the unity hymnal, as you might say, clearly training their fire on Rauner. I think for, you know, Ray is 100% correct that there was a big push toward, you know, sort of unifying those Republicans. But, you know, we're still mired in a debate over whether Jeannie Ives should call Bruce Rauner to concede or whether he should call her.
He didn't even say her name.
Yeah. And so there's, you know, clearly some hurt feelings left there. And I think I would not have predicted 3 months ago or certainly 6 months ago that we're talking about the lack of unity in a Republican party where you have an incumbent governor versus a, you know, Democratic Party that's trying to regain the state house after three really contentious years out of power.
You know, the Democrats, especially up here in Cook County, they are fractured in the way that you have a new machine kind of coming out with Chuy Garcia and the progressives. You have an old machine, which is Joe Berrios and Mike Madigan. How does any of that play out in not getting behind J.B. Pritzker or causing some headaches for Democrats as they take on the general?
No, I think it's anti-Rauner all the way. But as we get into municipal elections and as we get into Cook County Democratic Party elections for choosing leadership, I think Joe Berrios is up for re-election 2020 as the head of the party, but I think there will be a lot of jockeying before then. I do not think it will show up in the gubernatorial, but it will show up in a lot of smaller ways.
Well, let's do this. Let's take a break and we'll get an update on tonight's news. But when we come back, let's talk about the new machine, if you will. Yeah. The movement. It's not a machine, it's a movement. Chuy Garcia and some in the progressive circles here in Cook County had big nights, and their candidates has showed impressive gains and maybe showing a shift in what we know to be Cook County Democrat politics. you know, coming up here in 2018 and beyond. In studio tonight, AD Quigg, Heather Sharone, Ray Hodge is on the phone. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news, and we will come back and continue breaking down what happened yesterday in Illinois' primary. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Justin Kaufman here. It's Download 720 WGN. In studio tonight, AD Quigg, Heather Sharone, and on the line, Ray Hodge from Springfield. We're talking about last night's primary election 2018 for the state of Illinois. We now know what's going to be set up for the general. And, you know, the general is coming up here in November, and this is a very quick turnaround. But the municipal election, which will, of course, the mayor of Chicago and all of the aldermen is right on the heels of that, coming up in February. It's crazy. That's the first of before any runoffs. Breaking news out of that already. You know, it's so interesting because someone told me, they told me at the last month, they said, look, the day after the primary, you're going to start seeing people announce. And tonight we got we got one.
Gary McCarthy is back, fired by Rahm Emanuel for his role in the Laquan McDonald shooting and alleged cover-up, will run to deprive his former boss of a third term. He says he's running because it's, quote, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to save a great American city.
Wow.
Save it from what?
Well, you know, from Rahm Emanuel.
From Rahm Emanuel. Interesting, and obviously this is not that much of a surprise because there's been rumblings for the last couple months about Gary McCarthy, the former police chief who has been, you know, has a direct pipeline to Michael Sneed and sometimes saying whenever, you know, there's any fundraising. Hasn't been that impressive in how much money he's raised, or he's done a lot of putting it out there, see who's interested, but it looks like he's a go.
Well, what's interesting is that I took a look at his reports, and he reported today $34,000 in donations. So he's clearly very serious about this. What's interesting is, you know, we just spent a half hour talking about sort of this rising progressive movement in Chicago and in the state, and under no circumstances could you refer to Gary McCarthy as progressive. I mean, he is running from Rahm's right.
And that's order candidates.
Sort of boggles my mind because in Chicago right now, Rahm is about as far right as you can get. And Gary McCarthy is going to try to find space to get on even further right than
now,
Rahm.
Now, we've talked about Gary McCarthy. And Ray, I want to bring you into, you know, we'll talk, we'll get back to Rauner and Pritzker in just a second. But staying on McCarthy, you know, a guy who you can make an argument was liked as the police chief by the rank and file police officer. You could also make an argument that he wasn't because he came in with a lot of reforms. But then at the same time, he was. I had several people on this show before the Laquan McDonald stuff asking from the black community, leaders, aldermen, others, the black caucus saying, he's got to go. We don't like what he's doing. We don't like the way that the police is interacting with the community. We have an issue with Gary McCarthy. How does he move forward in the fact that a lot of in the African-American community didn't like him when he was police chief?
Well, I think that has gotten lost, and, you know, reasonably so, because before Laquan McDonald, the video of his death, you know, the black caucus on the city council called for him to be removed. I mean, before Laquan McDonald.
Right. So this was like a 6-hour budget here where they just railed against him.
So this was not somebody who was popular among aldermen, and, you know, your role as mayor in Chicago is to propose not only a budget but initiatives and get that through the city council, which this would be sort of uncharted territory to have a mayor without deep political connections to any alderman. Because you can say, you know, Rahm came, you know, from Washington after being President Obama's chief of staff, but he still had been involved in Chicago and Illinois politics for decades by that point.
Regardless of all of that, the fireworks that will happen in this race, because the police chief, the former police chief who was ousted by the mayor over one of the biggest issues in Chicago history, the shooting of Laquan McDonald, which is still playing out in courts. There's going to be a lot of finger pointing. There's going to be a lot of we are going to be picking at that fresh scab of what happened there between these two politicians. A lot of pointing fingers and questioning who saw what tape, when, how, where, and what was politically motivated. Right. Not a great candidate for Mayor Emanuel.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that we saw a poll a couple weeks ago that showed Rahm Emanuel's approval ratings bouncing back from sort of the bottom that he hit during the Laquan McDonald scandal. deal. But it would seem to me that the last thing he wants to do is to relitigate this issue, which for not necessarily African-American Chicagoans, but for I would think some white Chicagoans had sort of faded into the background of, you know, courtroom updates and that guy's on trial and, okay, you know, is he ever actually going to go to trial? But this sort of brings that right back to the forefront. And, you know, was McCarthy fired, you know, to cover up whatever happened with this videotape, which, you know, has been the big sort of underlying question of Rahm Emanuel's second term. Would he have earned a second term against Chuy Garcia had we have seen this tape as an electorate the election?
I'll put on my layman popcorn hat here and say, you know, I will say, and I'm not a political expert by any stretch, but that fight and all that's going to go into that and what could come out of that almost opens up a lane for another candidate. If another candidate come in and say, I'm not those guys,
we're going to see a progressive.
Can a progressive come in and challenge as while they're tussling over who did what for Laquan McDonald, be able to say, there's another choice over here and it's not these guys?
Yeah. Well, and to bring it back to yesterday's primary results, I think that a lot of progressives like Chuy Garcia, like, Luis Gutierrez, who's going to sort of play an elder statesman role in the Latino political community, at least for the next little while, are going to look at these results and say, there is a path to victory. We knocked off Ed Burke's brother. We can do this. Mm. There's, you know, the share of the Democratic electorate with which Ray talked about, that there were so many more people pulling Democratic ballots this time around than there were in 2014. I think has given people on the Democratic side hope that if a credible candidate runs, you know, there's a path to the left.
Let me bring Ray in. Ray, you know, another race down in Springfield that people are talking about today is the attorney general's race. Of course, Erica Harold wins on the Republican side. Kwame Raoul, the state senator. One of the big issues, you know, public corruption always comes up in this campaign, but one of the big ones is about accountability police and consent decrees. Of course, the attorney general plays a big role in enforcing consent decrees or suing police departments and things of that nature. You know, when you think about those candidates and how they're going to form their candidacies, do they look at all to the municipal election? Do they look to what's right behind them 3 months after?
Yeah, certainly. Especially when you've got someone like Kwame Raoul, who has had to, you know, wear both hats. Not only is he addressing statewide issues as an attorney general candidate, but his past coming out of this realm of, you know, Chicago focused work in criminal justice reform speaks to this really, really specifically, in fact. I mean, not only has he been involved in discussions on gun control that are specific to the district that he works in, but obviously he's got a good long history of these criminal justice reforms that he ran on during a statewide electorate campaign. So, you know, it's really bridging two realms here. It's bridging the statewide call for, you know, gun reforms and criminal justice reforms, as well as a very Chicago-focused and Chicago-informed perspective. Mm-hmm. So Kwame Raoul definitely, you know, he pulled in that conversation, and I think his positions on this are going to continue to sort of be leading positions in how the conversation forms around it. Now, you also saw, the Republican candidate who won her primary for Attorney General, Erica Harold. She would be an excellent one to look at this as well, because what we're able to discern here is that her position on criminal justice reform, she said in her releases and in her public statements that this is something that she wants to take a more bipartisan approach to, as she puts it. So, you know, there's not really a monolithic opinion about these criminal justice reform initiatives, about the police accountability initiatives that are in Chicago. Chicago being what it is and informing state politics all the way down here in Springfield, you know, even in that case, we do still see a pretty wide spread.
Heather?
This is going to also play a role in the mayoral election. We've got the attorney, you know, whoever the next attorney general is, will negotiate a consent decree that will govern the Chicago Police Department and limit whoever the next mayor's powers are.
So even with the Justice Department and the City of Chicago kind of backing off.
I think the consent decree will be decided before the next attorney general comes, and they will be in charge of enforcing it. And I will be interested to see what their priorities are going in.
Yeah. A.D. Quigg, Heather Sherrone, Ray Hodge on the line. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll continue to break down what happened yesterday in Illinois' primary election. Stay with us. Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. 80 Quig, Heather Sharone, Ray Hodge on the line. We are talking last night's primary election. Yeah, all of the guests tonight are members of the Daily Line, which is the publication that covers all things city, county, and state. County, and I got this also plays in the state, and I think we talk about Chuy Garcia. Chuy Garcia, who was a Cook County commissioner, ran for mayor, forced the mayor into a runoff last time around, became the heir apparent, and was essentially given the 4th district seat for the retiring Luis Gutierrez. But he's also, in this time, you know, he was a delegate for Bernie Sanders. He's becoming more of not just a candidate, but he's becoming a machine leader in the way. I mean, they call it the movement. It's not a machine, but
yes.
But there seems to be candidates that are involved with the progressive movement. Had big days yesterday, up and down the ballot.
Yes. So Chuy Garcia, everyone expected him to win that race. We just didn't know by how much. What we weren't sure of is how many people he could bring along on his coattails. So he had introduced a slate of candidates where he said, "I'm endorsing Alma Anaya to take my seat on the county board."
She won.
I'm endorsing Aaron Ortiz to take on Dan Burke.
He won.
I am endorsing Beatriz Frosto Sandoval for to be judge. She also won. And I'm endorsing Fritz Kagi to be assessor. Also won.
Wow.
So Chuy got on stage for his victory party holding a broom, and people were chanting sweep, sweep, sweep. And I talked to two aldermen who were kind of traditional HDO guys, old Hispanic Democratic Organization, very machine, came up through the machine, who said, "Chuy's the kingmaker now," and both of us recognize that and know that we kind of had to hop on board or else we would be screwed in 2019.
Heather, is there a future for this movement? I mean, does it look like Chuy Garcia is stepping up to those days of the HDO, the days of Latino caucus and Latino politics? Is it coming up here?
Well, what's interesting is, you know, Chicago is now a third white, a third black, and a third Latino. So I think the days where you can talk about Chicago politics in terms of black and white are over. And I think yesterday's election was you know, just the, you know, clearest sign that we've had that it's not just sort of who's going to win the black wards. It's now who's going to win that Southwest side, which is no longer, you know, under a lockdown by the Burke family.
Right.
So the question becomes, you know, in the context of the municipal elections in 2019, I don't think there's any doubt. And I think Clem Balanoff of Our Revolution said today in the Sun-Times, we're going after Ed Burke if he chooses to run again. That should, that 14th
now,
district or that 14th
this
ward.
Is so interesting. And Ray, I'll bring you in here. You know, when you start thinking about some of the big Madigan-backed politicians down in Springfield, and they've had success, the demographics in their home districts has changed. And it's something in Chicago politics that's been, for a number of years, head-scratcher, where you've had white aldermen in black wards, you've had white power players, the Speaker of the House included, in majority Latino wards. In Springfield, does the Madigan establishment, I mean, they had a big night last night as well, but do they have to keep their eye on this? They have to start thinking about the fact that, that things are changing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what was clear yesterday among a variety of these races, even if they were candidates that Madigan was backing, or if there were candidates that Madigan opposed that lost their races, you've still got a lot of struggle, right? So there was an excellent take, I thought, that came up recently saying that the blue dogs are an endangered species. You know, you used to be able to kind of pull these things together, but there was a lot more fight that went into it this time around than, you know, had been seen before. There was a pretty good struggle here. Everyone got a run for their money. Now, part of that, of course, is, you know, dealing with, as we were talking about, an up-and-coming kind of progressive shift in the way that these sort of political bouts are handling. But you've also got to look at why that is occurring. The base, as you're saying, the population, as you're saying, it is maturing, it is growing, it's developing. It's not always going to be, a centrist sort of heterogeneous or, homogeneous population
of predominantly white political players. This is what I think that the light bulb going off for a lot of people probably listening right now is that Republicans have spent a lot of money and a lot of airtime and a lot of breath on Mike Madigan, right? They have talked about him being the boogeyman. Is it possible And we've seen this in other, but I think of Eric Cantor as an example in Tea Party, where there are maybe the threat to Mike Madigan and his empire in Springfield has to do with a progressive Democrat candidate coming into his district and having an opportunity to beat him at home.
I think that's 100% true. Yeah. You know, it does Mike Madigan read the tea leaves and say, gosh, I've had a great run?
He did this already in the Alma and Aya race. He backed Alma, which was Chewy's candidate. And she was running against Angie Sandoval, who is State Senator Martin Sandoval's daughter, and
big
also a longtime ally
yeah.
of State Senator Tony Munoz, who are like the old HDO guys. So I think we're already seeing Madigan starting to recognize
he's smart
that this
enough
movement
to recognize. But still, I mean, I would think that if you want to be in Democrat politics and be a player, the county chair with Joe Barrios' seat, and of course the statewide chair Mike Madigan, that's who you go after. I mean, Ray, I mean, obviously yesterday it's just a primary, but the sweep of Chewy Garcia and the candidates that were that he endorsed, it has to be an alarm down in Springfield.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and here's the thing. I don't know that it's so much of an alarm bell as it is just kind of a sort of affirmation of what was already, you know, spoken about, what was already known. You know, there's not a great deal of shock about that I've picked up on anyway, about these House races that, you know, Madigan has made some sort of statement on. It was almost expected that things would play out to this degree. But I'm absolutely backing AD up on what she's saying here. That suite of candidates, now that one, that's a real shocker. That one's a, you know, it was expected, as she said, even down here, it was expected that he would really clinch it. But I don't think anyone really had any idea just how far those coattails really did go.
All right, here's what we're going to do. You guys, we got to stick around for one more segment.
Absolutely.
Can we do another segment? We
sure.
still haven't been able to talk. We haven't really talked about the U.S. House races. I think that there is something there. I mean, what I love about the Illinois primary for this year is it's all about the state races, no doubt. But what gets, and I love it because I'm so into local politics more than national, but there is a national midterm referendum on Donald Trump that is coming up here in November. And what did last night say about what we can expect coming up in November? Heather Sharone, AD Quigg, Ray Hodge on the line. We'll take a quick break and we'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, having a good old conversation, kitchen table conversation.
Kitchen
about,
table issues.
Kitchen table issues, politics, the primary last night. Ray Hodge on the line from Springfield, also in studio. Heather Sharone, AD Quigg, all from the Daily Line, which covers all things city, county, and state when it comes to politics. We're talking about last night's election and the storylines moving forward. Of course, the seventh storyline from the primary, which I just love, that's what I love about Illinois and Chicago, is this concept that the what everybody else is talking about in the East Coast and all of the players about what's going to happen with the midterm. Nah, that's a seventh storyline here. But there were primaries last night that set up crucial races for what could be showdowns for the U.S. House in the midterm election coming up in November. The one we talked about earlier, Dan Lipinski, the Democrat, who narrowly defeated
Newman.
Marie Newman. And now it's a foregone conclusion he's going to win.
Yes.
He's up against the candidates,
Nazi,
the
Arthur Jones,
Nazi,
actual
right.
Nazi,
perennial candidate,
yeah.
neo-Nazi.
So that's it. I mean, right now, I mean, even Republicans have withdrew their support. Nobody wants
yeah.
him there.
Yeah, and they also feel extra bad because they haven't had their eye on the ball and run an actual candidate.
They could have had a shot. I mean, it seems like Lipinski was a guy that was vulnerable.
Right, and I heard on the Southwest side there were a lot of Ives signs in Lipinski's district as well, which is interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when we talk about the fourth, it was Chewy Garcia who looks like he's going to win in the general. But the all eyes on the sixth district, this is a district where there were seven or eight Democrats are all lining up to take on Peter Roskam, who the National Democrats have circled on the big
yes.
list as a vulnerable Republican seat.
Because he is a Republican representative in a district that Hillary Clinton won. So that makes it a prime target for the National Democrats to come and take that seat. So the Democrats need 22 seats to take control of the House of Representatives. So if that's going to happen, they're going to have to win seats like Roskam's, which is in an area that's becoming less rural and more suburban urban.
Mm-hmm.
And that you're having, you know, sort of towns like Naperville no longer really being suburbs, but being sort of urban centers right. in and of themselves. And that's changing the demographics of those towns and making them younger and more left-leaning. And whether they actually pull it off, I think, will tell us a lot about what happens with the U.S. House.
Sean Casten won that, and he will take on Peter Roskam. That was a field of, I think it was 8 candidates, yeah. 6 women,
yeah.
and the dude won.
The dude won. Yeah.
It's like, all right. And that was a late bloomer. They had so many. They have so much trouble with the DuPage glitches out in DuPage County. That came in late. As we were on last night, the challenge, Kelly Mazuski, she was in the lead, but that changed overnight.
Ray Hodge was up all night watching that one.
You were. Ray, what does that mean? What does Sean Casten bring, and what do you think Sean Casten can does he have a chance to unseat the incumbent?
Well, you know, I tell you, up until about 3 in the morning, no one thought that Sean Casten had this. And he came from behind with a massive surge to finally overtake the front runner. But he's come out of a crowded field. He has an interesting sort of background here. He's a scientist. So there's a completely different sort of feel to this whole thing. And of course, Roskam's seat being targeted for what it is, particularly with Roskam being a supporter of, you know, repealing the Affordable Care Act and things like that. It's very interesting to kind of watch this one as a petri dish, right, for future U.S. House races. And I think political watchers, even on the national level, should really be paying attention to these handful of congressional districts in Illinois, which is, you know, as we all know, the state of averages, right? You know, we've got quite a great way to look at our state as a microcosm for a lot of these political races. This is no exception. You know, he really came out ahead, fought the battle, was very tough about it. It was a very difficult victory for him to seal. But he's going to have to now be the one to take on this contentious seat, the one that, you know, national Dems really want to pick up. You've got other seats that are still at play here. You know, you've got Representative Darren LaHood. His challengers emerged last night over in the congressional district as well. And you've got, Junius Rodriguez, who pulled in with a narrow lead. You've also got people like, U.S. Representative Rodney Davis out in the 13th. Now, Davis had a pretty large swell. It would be very difficult to unseat a Republican there, but Betsy Dirksen Lundergan, you know, she really knocked it out of the park last night in the Democratic primary. So if there's still some momentum there, it might be more than just one or two congressional districts that get flipped. Like, this could actually start pulling in some momentum.
Let me ask you this, because Heather will bring you in, because last night Jan Schakowsky was on with us, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, and also Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. And then J.B. Pritzker also mentioned this kitchen table issues. And I picked it up quick because I was like, what is that? Like, when Jan Schakowsky said it, I was like, she's like, Democrats are running on the kitchen table issues. We want to bring back jobs and growth in the middle class. And then I felt like, oh, I heard that before.
We're running to the middle.
Then I saw Pritzker kind of look down at the card last night in his acceptance speech to say the same exact phrase. Yeah. The messaging has begun.
Yeah.
It seems that Democrats are going for this right down the middle class, grow the economy to take on Donald Trump and the Republicans.
Well, it's one of the legacies of the Clinton-Trump battle, because there were, you know, of course, all of those postmortems that said that, you know, Clinton didn't do enough to focus on jobs and the economy and sort of those nuts and bolts issues, and instead spent too much time focusing on Donald Trump's personal faults and his, you know, just not being qualified to be president. So kitchen table issues is going to be the way that Democrats say we're focused not on Twitter and, you know, the Mueller investigation and Russia and all of the things that we see in the national media, but we, you know, message, we care about you having a job and being able to feed your family.
I think this is also, the other option is that they could run like Bernie and
yes.
run identity politics, progressive socialist kind of leaning stuff that fired people up for Bernie that Hillary Clinton decided to eschew.
Yeah. Will they, though? I mean, that's at the core of this party, right? Is you saw with the special election outside in Pennsylvania where you were thinking, and the guy that ran there was saying that he didn't support Nancy Pelosi and showed much more social conservative issues. You just wonder if the people who are in charge of the messaging and the DNC and everything in Washington want to distance themselves from the progressive. I mean, that's the conflict, right? That's the conflict right. at hand
well, and
when it comes
it depends
to Democrat
so
politics.
Much on the candidate, too. Like, can yes. the candidate carry that message? Bernie Sanders could carry that message. Right. Not every candidate
and
can.
What sort of district are you running in?
Exactly.
You know, is this a district where it's, you know, a solid blue district? Then you probably have a little bit more runway to talk like Bernie Sanders. However, you know, in a state like Illinois, which has had a Republican governor for the last 4 years, I think you're going to see a lot of Democratic candidates wanting to sort of toe that line of, we are not socialists, mm-hmm. but we're not Republicans, and we're not scary, and we can actually govern, as opposed to sort of being engulfed in
a two-year budget battle.
I was right. going to say a 700-day
but,
budget.
Ray, and I know you're new to Springfield in the sense that you haven't been there for decades, like some of the politicians that are in power. But, you know, the long history of the state of Illinois is that the Speaker of the House, Mike Madigan, has been, what kind of Democrat you call him, because he's more of a Chicago Democrat, the Chicago machine type player, power player. But the question I have is, you know, he has had, he's headbutt with Republican governors, Democrat governors, every governor that's been in there. When Mike Madigan is the Speaker, he has had public squabbles. I mean, with Pat Quinn, it pretty much ended Pat Quinn's political career. Rod Blagojevich, that played out. That was a unbelievable stare down to the last minute of one party fighting with each yeah. other. So how
let me circle back around yeah. to this, because just moments ago, one of the things I said was that Illinois is a state of averages, right? Every time the U.S. is studied, every time economics or politics are looked at, Illinois can often be a petri dish or a microcosm, except on one thing, House Speaker Mike Madigan, right? Nowhere else in the country do we have this sort of idea, this symbol, this particular type and flavor of politician with the particular type of charisma and control and political nuance that he has, right? So if we take that into our equation of how Illinois itself is changing on the landscape, I think we're going to get lost in terms of being able to look at this politically accurately. Yeah. But I think if we look at the rest of the races here, we are at risk of considering Democrats being the only one who have their, you know, their progressive problem or their extreme end problem. What we saw last night was a very clear example. Whether you are a Republican or whether you are a Democrat, if you are poor, if you are disenfranchised, you are angry. You are ready for a person who is going to come in there with a very strong focus on making things economically sound and a very strong focus on doing that in places, particularly where your identity is most common. Now, whether that manifests itself as progressives that are deep in the heart of Chicago, or whether that manifests as a very hard line, very far right version of, you know, a Republican here in central and downstate, you've got the same underlying principle, and that is business as usual is no longer acceptable. And so I think if the DNC ignores that and ignores those signs, they will be at risk of probably doing the same thing as 2016. And likewise, I think if the Republican side of affairs here on the state government level ignores that, they'll be kind of at the risk of what we saw, you know, from Governor Bruce Rauner last night, yeah. where he got within 4 points. You know, that's a big chunk right there to take out of him.
That's well said. All right. Well, I think we've did it. I think we solved. We solved.
We fixed it, guys. Great
yeah.
job.
No,
that's it.
This is great tonight. You guys, thanks so much for coming in. A.D. Quigg, Heather Sherrone, and Ray Hodge in Springfield. They work for The Daily Line, which covers all things city, county, and state. Check it out at thedailyline.net. Join us every Wednesday here on the program. Thanks for being here. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot.
You know, I haven't seen former Superintendent McCarthy in a while. Just, you know, you see his quotes and things. I still buff, still working out. I think still got the muscle tone. I haven't paid attention.
Yeah, he's looking good.
Yeah, when he would get in the summer months, that white uniform on with the short sleeve.
Oh, yeah.
Guns a-blazing.
He's not as jacked as the other guy. Was
Jody Weiss, right.
Jody Weiss, yeah. He was really jacked up.
You just it's a prereq, I guess, if you're going to be running the police department. You got a guy. You got to have the guns, right? Exponent, I want to go to that.
Yeah.
That sounds fun. The 13th through the 15th at the Schaumburg Convention Center. That seems like it'd be right up not only your alley, Pete, but Greg Flam's alley, who's on tonight with the swap meet, because he always brings in records and other things that he finds there. You had found the vinyl of the refrigerator and Walter Payton rapping.
Yeah, rapping together.
That's what it was called, yeah. Right? Rapping together.
They were both in tuxedos on the cover, sealed.
Right. Maybe we can go find that and then bring it to the Expona Expo and see if we could play it in one of the rooms for a bunch of people at really, like, really crystal clear audio. You know, like, everyone goes in there with their cool records and they're like, this is how it should be. Put your headphones on. This is how it should be played. And we're like, oh, how about this Walter Payton fridge rap?
Yeah.
How was this supposed to be heard?
I go to a lot of these record, you know, I guess not fairs, but maybe record fairs, I guess you would call them, where, you know, people are selling their old vinyl. And they do, there's a lot of vendors that have like a toy turntable. So you could listen to the, and it's really annoying seeing, yeah, like, you know, really? Come on.
What I want to know is, you know, and I wish you get the Exponent people on.
Yeah. When is that?
Coming up mid-April.
Yeah.
But I want to know, and I find it interesting, is you know, it used to be that you would sit down in the basement in your cool, like, your round chair that you would dig into, and then you'd put the huge cans on. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
those huge headphones, and you'd listen to, and that was the way you did it as a teenager, right? If you got the High and Dry record from Def Leppard, that's where how you're rocking it. Has it changed? I mean, are they going with the little buds now, but the same concept? Has the furniture changed? Like, yeah. I want to know. I mean, I hope they're still building. I know that it's probably inefficient or possibly not in style to have those huge headphones, but you would think that, like, a Beats by Dre or whoever, that's, you know, the big high end, the Shure, you know, yeah, headphones, if they're making those kind of headphones still.
Yeah, I think so. I think you see those, right, in like production shops.
Yeah.
Or on the train. Yeah, like you see a regular guy. Well, all right, guy.
All right,
stop
guy
showing off with your big headphones.
I told you, the one guy, I love this guy, Nick, my a great audio producer. I used to work with him at NPR, and he does a Love and Radio, which is a great podcast. And he was the guy, and he's a brilliant producer. And he would walk down the pier. We worked at Navy Pier. And you'd go down to the food court, you know, they had McDonald's and stuff like that, and you'd get like your $6 sandwich. And he'd be the one guy that would walk down there with his huge headphones on because he's listening to something for work, right? So I would take my headphones off and I would walk down to lunch, then come back to the studio and then put them back on.
Because you're an adult.
But yeah, exactly. And he would walk down there with these huge headphones on and walk around, like, perusing whether he wanted McDonald's or tacos or whatever. And I was always like, I would tap him on the shoulder, total bully move on my part. But I'd tap him on the shoulder and be like, no, get rid of those, man.
Yeah.
You got 5 minutes. Like, right now, this is not a good look.
It is not a good
Nick,
look.
It's not a good look.
I mean, I get...
You're brilliant, but this is not a good look.
I mean, I worked at another place, and I worked at a different shift, but it was late, you know, like 3 to 7, but I'd be there till like 9 trying to... And, you know, some days you're just like, oh, I got to get out of here. It's 9 o'clock. I'm not going to get home till 10, blah, blah, blah. And there's a production guy who also worked at the station, but he worked like 4, like he came in at 4 or 5. So he was just starting his day kind of when I ended.
Right, right.
And he'd always come in and chat. He'd always want to come in and chat about Clerks or, you know, so he's a big Kevin Smith guy. And I loved him. You know, he's a great guy, right, you know, other than he would spit tobacco in his big Dunkin' Donuts cup and talk to me about Kevin Smith. But I realized, though, if I really had my headphones on,
he wouldn't bother
you. He wouldn't bother me.
So you were the guy.
So I was that guy. I was that guy. He was an audio guy,
yes,
you know,
like,
so he knew, you know, he, like, it's sacred and don't interrupt a guy with the cans on.
Yeah, when I go down Michigan Avenue, when I come up from the bus and I come up here to the station, there will be a ton of solicitors. There are people trying to get you on apps or trying to get you on Greenpeace, whatever they're trying to get you on. But the one thing that you have is social contract. Is if you have headphones in your ears and they stop you to say, can I talk to you for a second? You have to pull that bud out of your ear. That's a faux pas.
Yep.
You have ruined somebody's vibe, someone's mood, right?
Yeah.
And so when I come up on those guys, I bob my head a little bit more. Like, whatever's
really
in there, I'm like,
really
like it, man. And it's a human thing where people will not, they cannot cross over that mental bridge to, like, break somebody from a groove. And if you look like you're in a groove, they ain't going to talk to you.
Even if you're like listening to Terry Gross,
yeah,
it doesn't matter.
I'm listening to
bopping your head.
The Cars for Kids jingle, and I'm just like, bob that head. Let them know you're in a groove. And then if they do have the guts to stop you, then it's a 10-second, I got to undo the, yeah. I make it very clear you have interrupted my commute. I stop. I have to untangle. I can do everything I possibly can to be like, what's up? And they're like, can I offer you a new app? I'm like, nah, man.
I don't know who decided that this is a good business model. People do it, it must work.
Summertime is the worst. Every block.
Yeah.
Ugh. All right, coming up, Philip Earl Johnson's going to join us. He is the lead in An Enemy of the People at the Goodman Theater, Bob Falls' new show. And also, we're going to talk about Keith Haring's Chicago Mural, which was at Grant Park in 1989. The Chicago Cultural Center is putting it back on display. It was made by CPS students, 500 students in 1989. Two of those students are in studio tonight. They're now in their 40s, and they are professional artists. So we'll talk about what that project back in 1989, what famed artist Keith Haring did for them and their careers. That's coming up tonight on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the play Enemy of the People is now on stage at the Goodman Theater. It's a Henrik Ibsen play directed by Goodman artistic director Bob Falls. It's running through the 15th of April. The play is from the 19th century, but its central themes around corruption, moral integrity, even investigative reporting are still issues we see playing out in today's culture. The lead in the play is Chicago actor Philip Earl Johnson. Johnson's well known to Chicago theatergoers and television watchers, as he's performed at the Goodman as well as other area theaters over the past 26 years. He's also shown up in area television productions like Chicago Fire and Chicago Med, just to name a few. Philip Earl Johnson is known for his versatility on stage, but he's also known for his act Mooney, where he performs silent comedy with juggling and other skills akin to the European street performers. He's a regular on the Renaissance Fair circuit. Philip Earl Johnson, welcome to The Download. Thanks for being here. It's great to meet you.
Thanks, Justin.
All right, so first let's talk about the play. When I say central themes around corruption, moral integrity, even investigative reporting, that's not, when you know Ibsen and you know the play, it is pretty impressive that this stuff kind of still is in our lexicon in 2018.
Well, you could call it impressive, or you could call it, well, I guess we never learn, you know, because it's relevant today. It was relevant 5 years ago. It doesn't matter the country. The human condition seems to never change. And whatever, as Martin Luther King says, the arc of the human experience is towards kindness. But it's taken its time.
Well, the character you play Dr. Thomas Stockman, the character is designed to have this real dilemma. There's so much in there. Being the protagonist and the lead in this play, how do you approach that? I mean, this whole play hinges around which side you're on or how you interpret what's happening in this town.
Actually, I think the dilemma rests in the audience, how they respond to the dilemma, because there's actually relevant arguments on both sides of it. But the bottom line, of course, I'm in the center of it as Dr. Stockman. It seems clear to me what the right choice is, that we're going to choose people over money. But we do know that money is important, and we do know that community and what that community is based on is somewhat fragile, and we don't want to just rip apart what we've built.
And there's compelling arguments in the play for
absolutely
both.
Right, right. And so it isn't some sort of Machiavellian or sort of cut and dried surface melodrama where there's a hero on one side and a mustache twirling villain on the other side. That would be too darn easy, and Bob who did the adaptation is much too smart for that.
What did you know about this play before you became the lead actor?
I had done a reading of it a number of years ago that a friend of mine put together who pitched it for another theater in town. But that was, I'd heard of it, but that's my first exposure to it, a different adaptation. I think it's a tremendous play, and I loved it at the time that I did that. Little did I know that 2 years later that I would be playing Dr. Stockman.
You know, you hear this a lot with actors in Hollywood who, you know, when they get a chance to be the lead, and they seeked out the role. Or they possibly, you know, knew about the role and they really want it. When it becomes local actors and you're on stage here in Chicago, is that part of you see that they're going to do this play and you say, I really want to be a part of this? Or is the process completely different?
Well, I think that that has happened many times to me where I've seen a role and in my mind I went, I really want that role, but that's about as far as it goes. Like, so usually, you know, if you get an audition for whatever audition you get, I this one I happen to get through my agent. A lot of times in theater, we don't go through our agents. The casting director for that theater will contact us directly.
Right.
So any number of ways. But for this one, I was contacted through my agent for an audition and I went in and I gave a good audition. That's basically really the whole story. And though I was considered actually, initially I was called in to read Peter Stockman, who plays, he's the mayor, he's my brother. And I, you know, Bob was like, nice work. And then I was like, okay, I'll leave now. So I thought, well, I guess I didn't get it. And then that's, you know, actors, as soon as the auditions got, we're constantly going, oh, how did that, I don't know, how did I do it? I have no idea. Was that good? I don't know. And so then, you know, when they just say nice work, you're like, well, I guess I didn't get it. Well, then a week later, they're like, could you come in and read for Thomas Stockman? I go, oh, I guess I didn't suck. Okay. Well, then, so I come in for that and then, you know, I end up getting it, but that would, I would have been the last person to tell you that was going to happen.
When you take on a role like this and you get cast, does it then become, are you the kind of actor that studies the text, that believes in understanding the where it came from, who Ibsen was, what Norway was like in the 19th century? Or are you the kind of guy that's like, tell me where to stand and I'll do my best with whatever accent that I'm supposed to play in?
I love research because I love history. So I think that it helps inform, even in ways that are direct or indirect, anything is valuable. And, you know, until you show up for the first day of rehearsal, you might as well get busy doing something. So start learning about what it means to be a doctor in 1880. Learn about, I'm 50 and this was Bob's suggestion to start looking at research this way. Like, it's 1882, you're 50, I'm 54, but you know, do the math, go backwards. What was it like to grow up in Norway during that time? So I bought a lot of books. I ordered them online. Some of them are expensive, you know, but it's worth it to me because I love it and I read them all. So I definitely want to know as much as I can going in as possible. This one, we didn't, because it's a new adaptation, we didn't get the script until a week before the rehearsal started. So we didn't have a lot of time to spend with the text in and of itself, but I did spend a lot of time reading.
This is third or fourth, I can't remember the number, but it's kind of early in Ibsen's career in the sense that he had had a couple of big hits, plays. And the last one he did, he got a lot of criticism for it.
Yeah, he was actually, it was talking about venereal disease on stage.
Right, and that was taboo. That was obscene, considered obscene.
Correct.
And so this play, Enemy of the People, was really one where he was using it almost to strike back at his critics, strike back at the fact that he was taking on this taboo on stage.
It was absolutely a retaliation against the critics and the people of Norway who had rioted over the subject matter of his previous play. And apparently it was written in a very short amount of time in a fit of pique. And if you see the play, it won't be hard to see that.
Do you feel it in the text? Do you feel that rage that's coming through? And as an actor, do you feel?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. He is, you know, he starts out as basically Ward Cleaver. You know, he starts out as like the nicest guy. And then stuff happens to him that isn't what he expected. And he's fighting back. But he's fighting, you know, he's basically fighting to swim upstream in a big river. Like, try to imagine, you know, swimming up the Niagara Falls. Like, you can't do it. And that's what he's trying to do.
Interesting. Philip Earl Johnson is in studio right now. He's a Chicago actor who is the lead. He's playing Dr. Thomas Stockman in the play Enemy of the People, which is on stage at the Goodman Theater, running through the 15th of April. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We got to talk Mooney. And get you here, we could talk about your career, your full career in silent comedy.
Right.
Coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Chicago actor Philip Earl Johnson is in studio with me. He is playing Dr. Thomas Stockman in the Goodman Theater's play Enemy of the People, Ibsen's play Enemy of the People, which is on stage through the 15th of April, directed by Bob Falls, the artistic director. You wear two hats, many hats as Mooney, but you had such a prestigious and distinguished career on stage here in Chicago, but you also play a character that is rooted in European clowning. It's a well-known character here in Chicago, Mooney. It's a silent comedy. I guess you call it clown. Is it clown?
Yeah, clown can be confusing. It's a confusing word. So when you say clown, especially in America, you kind of want to qualify it. I consider myself a clown, but often I say comedian just so that people don't formulate. People have,
right.
There's baggage with clown, mime, you know, and since I don't talk, people think I'm a mime, and I'm not at all because I'm certainly not quiet. Very loud.
There's so much tradition in the performances, and I've seen them on YouTube and watched them all day today. They do come from a very distinct and specific kind of performance that was done in Europe and Germany and other places where you really can feel that. Talk about where it comes from, the art of Mooney.
Well, I saw other performers as a young person, and I admired the power that they had over an audience. And so I wanted to do that as well. But it also turned out to be a living. It really is how it is my bread and butter performing.
Really?
I perform coast to coast all year long. I travel all the time. I'm in theaters as well. So this is the majority of my performing experience is actually as Mooney and has been for 28 years. I've got over 7,500 performances of the show in the last 28 years under my belt. But what it comes from is every single day, every single show, I go out there and I engage the audience in a singular way, saying, this show is only right now. If we were to videotape this show, it wouldn't be as funny for the people watching it as it is if you're here right now, because I'm living in that moment. And that's what these street performers, that's what the German cabaret performers, the English music hall performers, they're performing live directly to the audience. What happens in the audience becomes part of the show. And that's why I think that I have been able to have such a long career in that, is that no matter what happens, I'm there, I'm present, and I am actively engaged with the audience. And sometimes it's confrontational.
Well, I was going to ask, how difficult is it? Take us through audience engagement is a hallmark of any street performer or silent comedian in this case. How do you engage without language, without being able to speak?
Well, I whistle. I have a very distinct whistle that I've developed over the years, and I would do it, but it would be very, very unkind to the listeners at home, so or in the car. So I won't do it, but it's quite loud, and I've developed a way of speaking by using the pitch and the cadence and the rhythm of speech, but using only the whistle. So that is actually the number one question that I guess. How did you learn how to whistle like that? Because you can hear words. It's like I'm printing words in people's brains without saying, because you can hear words, but I'm not saying words. So there's this sort of trance hypnosis, I think, that people get into, and they want to find out what I'm doing, because I'm doing tricks. But really, it isn't about the tricks. That's sort of like the skeleton of it. What it is the aliveness of bringing people on stage and watching me partner with people on stage and partner with the audience.
You see that a lot. I think American audiences have been exposed to this through Cirque du Soleil. You'll get a lot more clowning around the acrobats and things that are happening in Vegas, big shows, things of that nature, coming out to the United Center tent, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But when you really do get down to the more independent performances, and I think about Mooney as the Renaissance Fairs and also being someone who goes out and has to single-handedly do that without the awe of acrobats doing things that seem unhumanly possible, it's very difficult and very challenging. How do you do it? How do you, they're being able to play off of other things, for you to be able to go out and engage an audience and perform that show with very little warm-up?
Well, the warm-up for me now is that I've been doing it for 28 years.
So they know they're coming to see you.
They're coming to see me. I walk out and there's 300 people. It grows to 500-600 people every show, five times a day. And it's just like Don Rickles, you know, like Don Rickles, when Don Rickles would go, the best part of the show was when he would go off on somebody in the audience. For me, for the people that come to, you can literally hear if somebody's like giving flack or if they're doing something that isn't adding to the show, and I've warned them from the stage with my whistle or what, like, you know, I'll point out, you know, and if they don't respond, I will have to go and address them personally. And you can hear people in the audience go, oh no, here it comes. Oh no, here it comes. And that's what they come for. That's what they want. They want, because that's alive. Like, I'm dealing with something that's clearly just happening right now. And that's the thing. And that's what I try to bring on stage at the Goodman. And there are moments in any play that I'm doing, I'm trying to bring that aliveness of, wow, that guy's a little off the nut, a little bit, just a hair. What's going to happen? And that makes theater electric when you're not sure that it's going to stay on stage. You're not sure that you're safe. Just that little hint that we've got someone here that's not always playing by the rules, because I just think it makes it more exciting.
Absolutely does. It seems to be a lot of that has been taken from stand-up comedy, meaning in America will use stand-up comedy in the same way that you're talking about, that all the street performers and cabaret performers in Europe. American audiences know this, know Mooney more as, like you said, clowning, or we'll say, oh, he's playing a clown, or he's a mime, he's not talking. Because you talked right at the beginning of this just about American audiences. Are they coming around? Did they come around and say, now I'm understanding the art of this?
Oh, sure. But I'm not, just to clarify, I'm not playing a clown. I'm myself. Clowning is different than acting, in that acting, I'm creating a richly detailed, layered performance that portrays a human being in as great of detail with as many nuances as possible. Clowning isn't about nuances. Clowning is about living in a state of human condition, but at the very extreme of that. And people accept that. So, like, even if you're angry, they're laughing their ass off because they just think it's so funny that you would take it so seriously.
Right?
So you just are going hard, no matter what you're doing. It doesn't matter. So I'm myself, but I'm just using myself at the greatest pitch that is appropriate for any given moment. So it's not like I'm playing anything. It's more that I'm just unveiling my human condition and my vulnerability, and people respond to that.
I love it. Philip Earl Johnson, Chicago actor, Mooney as well, that you could see. You'll be at the Ren Fairs here in the area, and you'll have all summer. You'll be in different places. Where can we find out more information about Mooney?
Well, I'm at the Bristol Renaissance Fair every summer for 9 weekends, and then around the country, you know, I'm all over.
All right. Philip is starring as Dr. Thomas Stockman in the play Enemy of the People, which is now on stage at the Goodman Theater, the Ibsen play directed by Goodman artistic director Bob Falls. It's running through the 15th of April. Philip, thanks so much, man. It's a pleasure to have you here. Good luck with the show, and can't wait for the Ren Fairs this summer to see Mooney in action.
Come on up.
It's a Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, Greg Flamm will be here at DuPage Picker, of course, for our Wednesday installment of the Swap Meet. If you've got great memorabilia, collectibles, you want to know what it's worth, Greg is the guy to talk to. And if you got great Chicago memorabilia, this is the new wrinkle to the Swap Meet. If you got something you want to brag about that you just think, oh, this is the coolest thing, maybe some of the people in the studio right now might have it as well, but we'll talk about that in a second. But if you have that, if it's the best of the night, I'll give you a free pizza. That's what I've added to the mix. 312-981-7200. That's coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, this next story is one that started almost 30 years ago. Actually, more than 30 years ago. Famed street artist Keith Haring created a Chicago mural back in 1989 with the help of over 500 CPS high school students from 47 different schools. The mural lived at the north end of Grant Park, which is now Millennium Park. You would recognize it in the moment you see it. It's iconic. It was the colorful people and the landscapes outlined with the thick black lines. It was 488 feet. It was on display at Grant Park, but then it was broken up. Parts of it were on display in different CPS buildings. Some of it went into storage. A big chunk was up at Midway Airport up until this winter. Now most of it's back on display at the Cultural Center through September. It's a new exhibit called Keith Haring, the Chicago Mural. The great thing about this exhibit is that it brings back a real piece of Chicago history, and with it, the stories of the kids who painted it. And a couple of those kids from back in 1989 were forever inspired by the project, following a life in the arts. One of which, Eric DeBott. He was a CPS student who worked on the mural. He's in studio tonight. Eric, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Also, Irving Zucker is here. He was a project manager on the mural back in 1989, and he worked alongside artist Keith Haring. Irving, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And also Nathan Mason, the exhibition curator with the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. Nathan, thanks for being here as well.
Oh, you're welcome.
Why don't I start with you, Nathan? Talk about putting this exhibit together. This is, of course, an iconic mural. Many Chicagoans right away know what I'm talking about. What was it about this piece that you wanted to put on display at the Cultural Center?
There's part of it was functionality, that it was an opportunity that arose in a timely fashion. Since Midway Airport is going to undergo some remodeling, this mural has hung for a long time now in the connection between the CTA station the terminal.
Right.
And that is being rebuilt. And so it had to be removed. And I found that out last year, about March or so. The airport was like, okay, we have to do some things.
Do something with this.
And in thinking about it and thinking about our exhibition schedule and the fact that it's a major work of public art in Chicago, and we were also planning for this year's Year of Creative Youth, because last year was Year of Public Art, this merged both of those.
Yeah, it really does.
With all of the schools, all the kids who worked on it. And it was the rare opportunity to bring back a really significant work of art, actually really close to where it was, because we're across the street from that section of Grant Park, which is now Millennium Park, where it was painted.
Yeah.
And so you can look out, you can look at the mural, and then you can look out the window and see where it was painted.
It's amazing, too, because it's not just the mural on display. There's some great documentary footage. I mean, just some of the stuff that I was watching Chicago Tonight, and they had some of the footage from TTW, which is amazing to see Chicago in that way. And then to see the mural and be like, yes, I know I know that.
The WTTW documentary from 89 is a really great source, and we have that playing in the show. And one of the things that, so when I heard about this, I started reaching out, because Eric had actually been talking to me about, can we do something with the mural? So there was already interest, and I knew that there were kids around who are now adults, who are still functioning artists, who were working, and that it was something that has a long-term life. And that meant that they also had ephemera and memorabilia, and so we could tell the story of the mural almost in the mural's own words.
Oh, I love
borrowing it from Irving and Helen's collections of ephemera, really make it that I did not have to write a lot, just a very basic, simple history, and most of it, the story of Keith, the story of the kids, and Irving's participation tells itself, really.
Let's do this. Let's bring Irving in. I want to bring Eric in as well. But Irving, you were project manager on this mural back in 1989. You worked alongside the artist who was a famous pop artist at the time, Keith Haring. Talk about bringing Keith to Chicago. I mean, you knew him outside of Chicago. It wasn't you knew him. Talk about your work with Keith and why this project came about.
I would say one thing. He's more than the project manager. He's why it happened.
Oh,
the project manager is...
It's too formal of a title, right?
Of a term.
All right. The man who made it happen.
Well, I met Keith in New York in 1987, and a friend of mine who was a curator, Diego Cortez, I was at a gallery opening for a William Burroughs show, and he invited me to come to see that show that he mounted at Tony Schifrazzi Gallery, and he said, hey, you know, do you like Keith Haring's work? I said, yeah, I love Keith Haring's work. And he said, well, he's in the lower gallery, and why don't you go down there and see his show, and then I'll introduce you to him. You should do something with him in Chicago. Because I was always involved in arts and education projects. And so I go downstairs in the lower gallery, and I'm walking around looking at his show, and he's actually standing behind me, kind of following me from drawing to drawing, and I'm kind of giggling because they were really satirical and funny. And then Diego says, hey, you know, turn around, Keith's behind you. And
he was a famous artist at this point.
He was already quite famous and had done murals all over the world already, and was already doing murals with and other kinds of projects with kids of all ages, but especially high school kids. And so we met right then and there, and he said, you know, Diego says I should work with you. And I said, yeah, he told me the same thing. And he said, I said, that would be great. And he said, you want to come to my studio tomorrow? And which was a Sunday. And he said, let's meet in the morning and we'll brainstorm. And that's when it started.
Well, I was going to say, how hard was it to pitch the idea to do this in Chicago? I mean, was it a no-brainer? I mean, to be able to bring the kids together, 500 CPS students, to have that part of Grant Park, which is it wasn't as hoity-toity as Millennium Park is now. But was it an easy sell to the city to say, or was it a challenge?
I don't think it was much of a challenge, because when you're bringing somebody really famous in with a, you know, great reputation and lots of experience, it was a matter of making contacts. I knew Helen Goldenberg, and she was the chairperson of the Board of Trustees of the Museum of Contemporary Art. And I wrote her a letter and made a phone call first and wrote her a letter and said I'd like to bring Keith Haring. I met him and we talked about possibly doing something in Chicago. Would you be interested? Would the museum be interested? And she responded right away, sounds like a fantastic idea. And then another letter went out to the Chicago Public Schools, and I called up the Bureau of Art. I talked to a man named Bob Johnson, who was the director of the Bureau of Art. And Bob said, I really like that idea. That's really cool. Artist in residence with Keith Haring coming to Chicago to do a big mural with our high school kids. And so, you know, he said, write to the superintendent, a man named Manfred Bird. And I guess they powwowed ahead of time. And I got a beautiful letter back from him. And he said, yes, think this is going to happen, then let's meet.
Let's do this. Irving Zucker, who is much more than the project manager, the man who put this mural together, the Chicago mural. Keith Haring, Chicago mural, is the exhibit at the Cultural Center, which is running through September. You can see a big swath of the mural that was on display in Grant Park back in 1989. Tomorrow night, Thursday at 5:30, there will be a conversation with Irving Zucker and also Helen Goldenberg, the former president and CEO of the Museum of Contemporary Art. It's at the Claudia Cassidy Theater right there at the Chicago Cultural Center. That's tomorrow at 5:30. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then I got to bring in Eric. Eric, of course, one of the students who worked on this mural and is a professional artist in his own right, and I'm so excited to talk to him about what this mural and this project meant to him and get more of this awesome history lesson about public art and this mural that had such an impression on Chicagoans for years. It's a Download 720. Stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking about the new exhibit, which is at the Cultural Center through September. It is called Keith Haring, the Chicago Mural. And it's the story of the mural that was along the north end of Grant Park back in 1989. It was Keith Haring, a famed pop artist, and he had 500 Chicago Public School students actually paint the mural. It's a big project. Everyone knows that mural. It's the colorful people and cityscapes and the thick outlines, the thick black outlines. I'm not doing it justice on the radio, but in studio tonight to talk about the exhibit, which is at the Cultural Center, is Irving Zucker, who was the man who put it together, who brought Keith Haring to Chicago. Nathan Mason, who is the exhibition curator with the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events, and Eric DeBott, who was a CPS student who worked on the mural. And I want to start with you, Eric, in the second half here. As a kid, obviously we heard what Irving had to say about setting it all up. Talk us about how you got involved in this. What are the memories from 1989?
It was one of those experiences that you knew it was going to be life-changing. From my background, coming from subway art and graffiti, and being kind of a student of that culture, I studied everything about that in the East Village and Keith Haring. I knew of him years before he even was here. And so when that happened and I kind of got on board with it, I kind of just took every chance to kind of just get to know him and learn from
him. You were already doing subway art and graffiti art here in Chicago. Was it intimidating? Was the process intimidating, the idea that you were going to get a chance to work with the Keith Haring?
Somewhat, but I also saw it as an opportunity to kind of learn and see how a professional artist works. And he gave all of us a blueprint on how to do it. And it was very do-it-yourself, DIY. He gave a talk at Wells High School, and it was really inspiring in that sense of where he was just straight up telling everybody, you got to just do it, make it happen. This is it. You know, if you want to do something, you got to do it yourself. And that was kind of cool in that aspect. But talking to him personally, it was really like he kind of like laid it out that, you know, this, you've been doing graffiti, you've been making paintings, you know, now's the time to start doing shows. Now's the time to, if you're going on to college, you need to, you know, use the schools to further your career.
Did you take that advice? I mean, as an Absolutely. Artist at that point, I mean, because you were transitioning in a way, because we were talking in the green room about, you know, you had done the graffiti art, you were 17 years old or however you were. I mean, you had many different avenues to go. What did the experience with Keith Haring do for you as an artist?
Well, actually, after painting with Keith and hanging out with him, he kind of brought me into like doing my first show. Within six months, I had a solo show. And then following after that, 2 years later, I had started a clothing line, a streetwear line, and been exporting stuff to Japan. And it just kind of, you know, like set a blueprint for what I was going to do. And it furthered on into doing graphic design and just being a professional artist in that sense.
Irving, I want to bring you in just because I kind of mentioned this earlier, but I want to ask the question again. You know, the city of Chicago is a very, it can be progressive and it can be conservative in the same way. This idea of bringing in a renowned pop street artist, Keith Haring, who guys like Eric just told you as graffiti artists, they looked up to him, what he did in the East Village, the subway art he was doing in New York City. You could see possibly some pushback to say this kind of art, which is very is great, may not be the right thing for downtown Chicago to be, you know, endorsed by the city of Chicago. What goes into that? And, you know, what do you have to do to make sure the powers that be understand what this mural can be?
Well, I didn't find much resistance at all. And when I approached the superintendent, when I approached the director of the Bureau of Art, they thought it was a spectacular idea. So I was quite surprised, actually. I thought there might be resistance, but there wasn't. And then, of course, there's meeting after meeting after meeting. It's all about advanced planning, and if you start early enough and you take it step by step, you can get something that large done. I mean, think about all the parent permission slips that have to be and things like that. I mean, there are a lot of little details and meetings with different entities. For example, the Park Commission, because we had to get permission from the Chicago Park District to use a section of Grant Park.
Yeah, right.
And so I had to make a presentation to the commissioners. And, of course, there was some internal conflicts on the Park Commission. There were different factions, but they all agreed that, wow, what a cool project, and we'll give you permission. And in spite of the fact that, you know, during earlier resolutions, while I was waiting my turn to get up there, they were arguing with each other about all kinds of other things. But when it
sounds
came
like
to
a commissioner's meeting,
yeah,
right?
And it was my first commissioner's meeting. And but when I got up there, they loved the idea. You know, an artist in residence, a famous artist coming from New York. The one thing was insurance. Who, you know, because you're going to have kids in the park, who is responsible
if
for
liability? Yeah.
Someone falls down or whatever.
Well, let me do this. Let me bring in Nathan and we'll wrap up here. when you see this kind of piece, and we talk about the big piece that was in Grant Park, 488 feet, obviously what's at the Cultural Center is just a part of it. But when you see this piece and Keith Haring and what happened, bringing Eric in and all the kids and everything, where does it fit into the story of Chicago's public art? I mean, is this the number one? I mean, because you'll have Picasso and you'll have the other stuff, that the sculptures. Where does Keith Haring's mural fit into the history of public art?
I think it fits in pretty well. And it helps merge two really strong threads that Chicago has. Because one of the things we talked about a lot last year was 1967 and the 50th anniversary of the Picasso, right. As well as the 50th anniversary of the Wall of Respect, which was a community-based mural on the South Side that was really about African-American history and culture. And a very important artwork in Chicago for establishing a community mural movement, and that spread nationally. And so I think part of where Keith the Haring mural lies is bridging the blue chip art world and the community art world, and bringing in a lot of youth to work on that project. And it did it really, really well.
The exhibit is at the Cultural Center, Chicago Cultural Center, right downtown in Randolph. It's called Keith Haring, the Chicago Mural. Irving Zucker, who was a big the reason why this mural happened back in 1989, is here. Nathan Mason is the exhibition curator at the Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events. And Eric DeBott was a CPS student who worked on the mural and is now a professional artist. Tomorrow night at the Claudia Cassidy Theater, you can check out the conversation with Irving Zucker and Helen Goldenberg, the former president and CEO for the Museum of Contemporary Art. And while you're there, get a chance to see the mural and what's happening at the Cultural Center. Guys, thanks so much for being here tonight, and congratulations on the exhibit.
Great, thank you.
It's time for Swap Meet. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Here we are.
That's right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It is time for the Swap Meet here Wednesday night. You got some memorabilia. You got some collectibles. You got some junk. Hey, we'll evaluate it. That's right.
That's
tell you what it's
do.
Worth. 312-981-7200. Greg Flam can be found at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. Good to see you, bud.
Good to be back.
So today, I think, is the official first day of spring.
I know.
I'm not sure. But the point being that the season is getting closer for picking.
It is. Once we get that 60-degree weekend, I think we'll have our first garage sale. So I'm counting down the days, and I think we're about 2 weeks away. So after Easter, you know.
Okay, so we just were talking about the Chicago mural, Keith Haring's mural, mm-hmm. which was awesome. And it reminded me that tonight we also are giving away a free pizza, Lou Malnati's pizza, if for the best Chicago memorabilia brag.
Sure.
What do you got? It doesn't have to be worth the most. It's just whatever I think is the coolest thing. I think we've had some really fun things on this program. It's hard to beat some that were on the last couple of weeks. There was a VHS of Stephen Gary's New Year's special.
Right. And what was the Cubs pen? Was it the first week?
Yeah, there's the, yeah. And then,
and they were early calls too, so hopefully change that up.
All right, so what do we got? What'd you bring in tonight?
Just a couple things, nothing earth-shattering, but I got this really cool statue figurine of Pirates of the Caribbean, which Pirates of the Caribbean stuff is not very, doesn't do the greatest, but this I looked up, and it's like a $150 figurine, so I'm like,
wow.
Okay. So I got that, and it's
Sao Feng. But it's also the kind of toy that you're not supposed to play with.
Right.
What's the point of it?
Just look at it, yeah.
Just look at it.
Right. And then I brought in a really cool House of Blues jacket. You know, it's got, what do they call the leather sleeves? What do they call that? Baseball jacket?
Oh, yeah, bomber jacket kind of thing? Yeah,
kind of, yeah. It's got the leather sleeves with the nice logos on the arm, the front, the back. So it's pretty rare. It's about $250. So that is pretty cool.
All right. 312-981-7200. Last night was the election. So many great, races and everything that was happening. And I felt like I was in the middle of the coverage, and I was like, oh, man. And people would be calling in or talking about stuff. And I'm like, man, in 20 years, are we going to be looking for a J.B. Pritzker pin?
Right. I was just going to say, you scoop up all the pins you can.
Scoop up all the pins you can right now, all the yard signs you can right now. They might be worth something in probably 50 years.
Yeah. And if we miss this one, of course, 7 months,
there'll be more, right? All right. Let's start it off. They're lining up already. 312-981-7200. Let's start with Mike. Mike, what do you want to brag about tonight?
I want to brag about Walter Payton.
All right.
And I have the ultimate sports fan, because this is one-on-one. Do you remember Kangaroo Shoes?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When he was advertising in Kmart, stuff like that.
Right.
For that big, tall stand-up.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like he's, what's it, what's
cardboard
he?
Stand-up.
Yeah, the cardboard stand-up.
Yeah, what's he promoting?
Right.
The shoe brand, right?
Kangaroos.
Yeah, he always wore the headband, too, for that.
You know that football he was holding in that kangaroo?
Yeah. Okay.
I got the actual football.
Wow.
That was it. Huh. The cardboard stand-up signed.
Oh, wow. Yeah, there you go.
I have photo proof.
Nice.
Oh, great.
I'll have to see
right,
what
we'll
a
Payton
signed football.
Yeah, you're kind of breaking up there, so we'll let you go. But Mike's got a signed football or cardboard cutout. That's what I guess I
well,
gather
there was a cutout,
cutout of the kangaroo.
Brand, right, and in the cutout, I guess they had encased a signed football is what he's saying, and he got the signed football from the display. So I'm trying to find just a Walter Payton.
Oh, that old saw. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, you know, we all
got
that.
Sorry, I was confused.
It's really common, you know. And, you know, obviously that one is going to have probably a little bit more value than a regular Walter Payton signed football, I'm going to guess. And they look like Payton signed football is about 400 or so. So maybe start an auction there and see what else you can get.
You know, you cannot like swing a dead cat in this town without finding some sort of memorabilia signed by Walter Payton.
Yeah,
and I don't mean it. Yeah, but I mean everybody. That is everybody's claim to fame. I mean, I know it. I grew up with it. My buddy had his dad ran a car dealership,
mm-hmm.
and so he got Walter Payton. He got a book. I mean, everybody was like, "You got Payton. Walter Payton?"
Yeah. And he signed a lot. Ditka signed a lot.
You would think, though, like after time, that just like with the Ron Santo thing, you start signing a lot of stuff that a football signed by Walter wouldn't be as much.
Exactly.
It still is.
The thing with the Bears, though, is you have anything 85 Bears, that adds value to it. So that changes things a little bit.
Not as much as 78 Bears. Nobody's interested in the 78 Bears.
Was that the Jack Pardee era or what was that?
Hey, Walter had 900 yards. I mean, seriously. No. Yeah. All right, let's go to Charlie. Charlie, what do you want to brag about, Charlie?
I got an original Nintendo, the original Nintendo in a box. It's been opened, but nothing has been taken out of the package.
That's awesome, I love finding those. You know, you can find one open, and that's only maybe $55, but if you have one in the box, I've sold them in the past for like $200, $225 in the box. You got to have all the plastic covers, all the manuals, all that, so to be in that price range.
Nothing's been taken out of the box.
Awesome, you're probably in that range, then, like $180 to $225.
That's not bad at all.
Not bad.
No. I also have a Susan Lucci doll. She's a doll. She's a limited edition in her wedding dress with the confirmation that it was
what?
It's a collectible doll.
Whatever soap she was on, is that the idea?
Hospital,
was she General Hospital? One Life.
Think she's General Hospital. I think she's something else.
I'm sorry, All My Children.
Yep.
All My Children, yes, that's correct, yes.
Sorry, I was about to get...
Oh, it's okay, you know, she's been on there for like, 30, 40 years, I don't know.
Yeah.
And Walter Payton did not sign the wedding dress.
thanks for calling. No, it looks like there are none sold recently in the last 6 months, but people are asking like $125 for that doll, anywhere from $30 to $125, to be honest.
All right.
Okay.
That's
all
good,
right,
Charlie.
Well,
those are good those are good things right there.
Yep.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
I should have asked Charlie if I hung up. I should have said, does that come with Duck Hunt? Probably comes with
it
Duck
does,
Hunt.
It does, yeah. It was Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt, usually.
Oh, I love it.
And the question to ask anyone who has the first Nintendo, is it the Gray Zapper or the Orange Zapper? That's the nerd.
Duck Hunt.
Right.
With a dog that would come out there and go, meow, 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 meow. 312-981-7200. All right, we'll take our first break. We'll come back. We got Tom, we got Joe, we got Amy. Got some people who are on the text. We'll get to everybody here and swap meet with Greg Flam, so stay with us. It's the Swap Meet, 312-981-7200. We got people on the line right now. Greg Flamm in studio at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. We're evaluating your collectibles, your memorabilia. If you got good Chicago memorabilia, now's the time to call because I'm giving away a free pizza.
Yep.
Best brag.
Lou Malnati's.
Best brag.
Bring it.
All right, Tom. You ready? Tom, yeah. What do you want to brag about?
I got an old wooden icebox.
Wow. Okay.
So an icebox, when is it? A wooden
icebox? Yeah, the kind the Iceman used to come and put the ice block in to keep your stuff cold.
Wow. Yeah. Those are about 400, it looks like, and up. Depending on how large, how ornate the doors might be on it.
Yeah, so, it's all tiger oak and stuff.
Okay. Are the doors kind of like oversized from the actual box, or they seem to be the same size as the box?
There's three in the front and then the one in the back.
Okay.
That the Iceman would put the ice
in. Wow. I think, like I said, you're probably in the $225 to $500 range on that.
Okay, very good. Right, thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling.
All right, let's go to Joe. Joe, what do you want to brag about, Joe?
Hey, I got a couple mugs that I absconded with from the Playboy Club in
love
Chicago.
It.
All right.
How you doing, Joe?
Good. Yourself?
Good, man. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah.
Oh, you betcha. Hey, good one is either aluminum or pewter. I think it might be pewter because the familiar bunny head with the ears.
Sure, and it's got a clear bottom, right?
It's engraved. Yeah, it's engraved, so it's recessed.
Yep.
The other one is a charcoal gray, and it's about 8 inches. Oh, that one's about 6 inches, I would estimate. The other one is a charcoal gray, tall one, and the bunny head is actually coming out. Not embossed, but they're reversed. What would you call that?
Oh, wow. Okay. Recessed, I guess?
No, recessed is engraved, and embedded. Hmm. Concave, convex.
Oh, okay.
It's coming out at you, 3D.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that
one. Oh, this was a quiz? Oh, I thought this was rhetorical.
Yeah, it was a test.
Your Playboy memorabilia.
Now, I might be incriminating myself, but I told you guys this once before. They're stuffed with the original black and white long swizzle sticks.
Yeah, right.
Swizzle so it's a testament
hot,
to
right?
how long I've frequented it.
You got a ton of those.
Oddly enough, your swizzle sticks are probably worth more than that silver or pewter mug. You're probably in like the $15 range for the smaller with the clear bottom mug. The other one I never run across. I'm going to say still like 18 to 25. It might be a little bit more than that.
Okay.
And refresh my memory. I think you said the swizzles are $3 or $4 each or something like that?
They're usually better bought in lots of, 8 to 12 and probably $20 for a lot of 8 to 12. So.
Okay, so I got about 50, 60 of them, so whatever.
Yeah, the Playboy stuff, And it will sell fast, too. That stuff goes.
Comprende.
There
awesome.
You go. Thanks
thank
for calling,
you.
Joe. Good
thanks,
talk.
Thanks, Joe.
Adios.
All right. I love when Joe calls in, right?
Yeah, he's to the point.
It's awesome. You get to the point where you get these download swap meet regulars who will call in, and Joe always thinks and is very, what I love about him is that he takes the time to explain what he has, and he really gives us the details, so I love it. Thanks, Joe. Amy, what do you want to brag about, Amy?
Well, I have a side saddle.
What?
Yes, it belonged to my parents, and I'm guessing it's from maybe the late 1940s, and I just wouldn't know how much it's worth.
Wow, that's
all right. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
A side saddle. I automatically had a reaction to it to go, what? That's amazing. What is it?
Well, a lady wouldn't sit on a horse with her legs on either side of the horse. Right. She'd have both her legs on the same side of the horse. Mm-hmm.
That is so cool. You have one of these. All right.
Yeah, they're all over the place. Some as high as $1,200. I'm trying to get an actual sold. Yeah, one sold for $1,600 recently.
What?
So, yeah.
So, wow.
Yeah, so you might have something there.
$1,600 to ride a horse with the legs on the same side.
That's correct.
Yep, nailed it. All right. Well, that's awesome. Thanks,
that
Amy. That's a good one, too. I like that. You're a front runner right now. I appreciate it.
That's wonderful.
Oh, you might get a pizza out of this. So that's interesting. Side saddle. Right? Let's keep going. Mike, what do you want to brag about, bud?
Well, I got a Wilson basketball.
Mm-hmm.
But it was signed by a certain Chicago Bear.
Let me guess.
His name is Walter Payton.
Walter Payton, and of course.
He used to play basketball for the Good News Bears.
Okay.
So great. Right. What was that like?
1984.
So they would, Good News Bears, they go play like charity games and stuff like
they
that?
Would charity games at high schools and play against fire departments.
Yeah.
Police departments and college guys and
I love
whoever,
it.
Whoever, you know, and I have photo proof.
Yeah.
But it's a Wilson basketball.
Oh, signed by, so now, now
Walter
we're just.
Payton, they put us 34.
Yeah, it's signed.
Right on there. Yeah, it's all signed. I have photos of him in the basketball uniform.
Nice.
The Good Bears uniform.
Yeah, that, I mean, I would think that might be worth a little bit more than the signed football because it's not as common.
Very unusual.
Any. Yeah, so I think if you do an auction, you know, start at, say, 300 and see, go from there if you do sell it.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I know that, and this is a memory I've not brought up on this show, but when I went to McHenry High School, okay, I did the morning announcements. It was a real trendsetter. I was a groundbreaker.
Did you do like the
Greg.
Good morning?
I was
substitute
doing characters.
Vietnam
I was
for
like
your school
listening
name.
To the loop and trying to do ripping off Kevin Matthews as go. A you know 16-year-old. But because of that, the charity Bears, whatever that like you said, the Good News Bears, they were coming through to play the hospital or whatever it was, and I got to be the announcer at the game.
Very cool.
And it meant I just needed to read some stuff and I needed to, but I took carte blanche and I just started doing bits. And they kept going up and down the court, right? Instead of just saying, basket for Glenn Kozlowski, you know, I would be like, oh, look at that move. Yep. Like I turned into, instead of the PA announcer, I became the call play-by-play because nobody
Stacey
stopped
King
me.
Of-
yeah. So, yeah, exactly. Stacey King stole all his bits from me.
Right.
So what happened, though, the game was going on, and I was making fun of the Bears team, and Kozlowski came over. And he rapped early on, clown. We were clowning, just like Philip Earl Johnson was talking about. He came and he wrapped the cord around my throat like he was going to choke me out.
Nice.
You know, and the crowd all kind of laughed in the gymnasium. But it was like we were like the Harlem Globetrotters.
Very nice.
Yeah, see? I'm doing bits with Bears.
Early on, you know.
In the 80s. So how about that? I never told. Awesome. I completely blanked on that.
Yeah,
so I didn't even remember that. And then they mentioned that the Good News Bears.
Wow.
Greg, you were in my presence when I told that great story.
I will never forget it. I'll probably remind you of it.
All right, 312-981-7200 is the phone number, 312-981-7200. You can text, you can call. We're going to do the second half of the swap meet coming up here. It's still wide open for the pizza. I know that, I think it was Amy had the side saddle, but that's not necessarily Chicago memorabilia. I like the concept of the side saddle, but man, oh man, someone can sneak right in the second half and be like, I've got a Walter Payton tennis ball. Walter, what else did Walter sign? That's the second half of the swap meet. Greg Plantier, stay with us.
It's time for swap meet. Oh yeah, here we go. Oh, another man's junk is another man's treasure, like a gold tape measure. When you were a kid and your fingers in your nose, today you're a picker. Oh, it could be comic books or silverware. As long as it's old, has no mold, there's value there. It's time for Swap Meet with Justin Kaufman.
And Greg Flam.
Second half, let's
do
it.
That's right, the second half of the Swap Meet is on. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. If you've got great Chicago collectibles, if you've got great memorabilia, you got junk, hey, call up right now and we'll see if it's worth anything. And the best brag gets a pizza. If you got the best piece of memorabilia, Chicago memorabilia, and there are two texts I want to get to start it off. And then I'll get to the people on the phone. We got a lot of stuff to still get to. All right, we ready for this?
Yep.
All right, so 708 says, I've got a medium-sized super dog windbreaker from the 80s.
That's awesome.
What's it worth?
It's priceless.
I love the question right at the end. What's it worth?
Yeah, you're not going to find anything to compare it to.
Where are you supposed to look?
Yeah, there's nothing really compared that to. So I would just start an auction.
That's a good one, man.
I'd start at 100 though, 150 maybe, and start.
I would go in front of Superdog, and I would just like on a nice summer day, and I'd just be like, "Hey, who wants it? $50 and up. We'll start there." An '80s Superdog, medium sized windbreaker.
The medium kind of
brings down the phone.
No way.
Yeah.
You want XL or large, medium. You want a snug.
That's true. Maybe they made the mediums bigger back in the day.
I just love it. And I want to know if it's never been worn or if it's really worked in.
Mustard stain. So,
yeah. That's a beauty. All right. And the second one, which is so good. It's so good. Mm-hmm. 630 says, I have a Vanilla Ice t-shirt from a concert in 1991. Not only autographed, but he also wrote Word to Your Mother.
Awesome.
Pretty sure it's priceless. That's what 630 went. That's hilarious. Word to your mother. Hey, what's your name? It's Kyle. All right, let me just put word to your mother.
Right.
How hilarious.
Without the word to your mother part, they're going for like $50 signed.
Signed, but yeah, word to your mother might bring it up.
Yeah, another
that's
50.
That's another 50.
Yeah, easily.
It's priceless.
Yep.
That's my lead. Right there, the medium-sized windbreaker from Superdog in the 80s versus the Vanilla Ice t-shirt.
For what it's worth, my vote goes to Superdog, Jack.
Really?
Yeah. That's if I was at an estate sale and I saw those two things, I would grab the Superdog jacket.
But I just love, there's something really great though. I'm holding out though. I might, like yep, I said, I might have to bring Esmeralda in a little bit later. But word to your mother, I mean, word to yo mother, MUTHA.
And you put that in the text.
Pretty good. That's pretty good.
That's nice.
All right. 312-981-7200. Brian, what do you want to brag about, Brian?
Yes. How you doing?
Hi.
I'm good. How about you?
Good, good, good. What? Actually, my mom has, and it's on our pole barn, is a ice cream booth from Gady's Ice Cream in South Chicago, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when they closed the store, me and a friend of my dad's, we went and got it in his truck, and it's in our pole barn, and we got the table and the backings and the chairs.
Wow.
I don't think we have the cushions, though, but the table, like I said before, was roughly about 24 inches wide and the length of the regular booth.
Well,
and on the table, I can remember it had like a concave, like half circle, but underneath the table, the bubble gum from the people was still sticking
what,
there.
What made you go get raid that to end? Were you just like, this is a good table, Dad, get the truck?
Oh, no, my mom likes vintage junk.
Yeah. No, it
are
will,
you using it? Is it set up in the pole barn? Is it just collecting dust?
And storage.
Yeah, right.
What color is the tabletop? Is it like that turquoise blue or blue?
The tabletop is like a, if I remember right, a white and trippy, like with a gold accent.
Okay,
I
yeah.
think. But the side panels, the wood panels are like a turquoise orange. I mean,
perfect.
It's
just, yeah, perfect.
It's
the mid-century modern. Trendies will love it. They'll buy it.
What do you do with that?
Yeah, you'd have to do, offer up, and you'd have to pretty much like name your price and take a best offer, unless you put it on eBay and do an auction for it and still do local pickup. But no, it will definitely sell. That's for sure. It's just I can't give you a price because there's nothing really to compare that to. But if it's got those colors, those 50s, mid-century modern colors, that will definitely help sell it.
A lot of guys, I mean, I don't know where you're at. You got a 219 number and you're talking pole barn, so my guess is that you're not in
Indiana somewhere?
I'm
in LaPorte.
Okay, great. LaPorte. I love LaPorte. What I'm saying is you might, a lot of the, I bought a chest from a boutique in Andersonville, right? And it was way too expensive. My wife was like, "Oh, this is great for the TV," and I'm like, "This is not great for the TV." And we can go to the IKEA and get something for $40.
Right.
But I had to pony up on it. But they told me because I was asking. They say they go out to Iowa, to Indiana, to other places, and they kind of do what Greg does. They troll around into different places that for garage sales and whatever, and that's where they find the stuff to bring up to the city
exactly.
And fool dopes like me into paying way too much money for it. Right.
Yeah.
So there might be something there as well if you can get it in a position where you might be able to put it out on, like in almost like a garage sale type thing.
If you could haul it to one of the like inner city flea markets that go on throughout the summer, right? What, Maxwell Street or one of those, you would get good money for that.
There you go.
But you're probably better off just starting an auction on eBay and just do local pickup.
Start first by cleaning it off because my guess is you got a lot of junk on there.
Yeah, the gum might be a drawback, but the colors are...
I think the gum would be like game used.
Oh, man, I don't know.
I like it. I'm with you, Brian. I like the gum on there.
I think the guys might like the gum, but the
women all the other stuff you and your dad hauled in there and put on top of it. That's
right.
What I'm saying. Get rid of that stuff.
we, we, We got plenty.
Yeah,
got
exactly. Plenty. Thanks, awesome. Brian.
Good luck with it.
Thank you. Sure. Bye.
All right. There you go. That's a good one. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Kathy. Kathy, what do you got? What do you want to brag about?
Hi. So I've got this T-shirt never worn. So it's a red T-shirt, and it's Chicago Bulls. So it says the NBA's most wins in a season, 70 games won, Chicago Bulls, 416-96, Bulls over Bucks.
That's such an interesting shirt because it's not over yet. The season's not over.
That's weird.
Because if it's a 70th win on April 16th against the Bucks, they won 72 that year.
Was that the record setting?
Or maybe was it the next year they won 72?
No, they won 72. You're right.
But did they win 70 and 96, 72 and 97, 68 and whatever? My point being that it seems like maybe that would be weird, though, if they printed a picture for the third game to the end.
Yeah, I didn't know if what was the record before that? Like how many wins? Was it 69 wins?
69 wins was the record, yeah, and so they ended up winning 72.
You're right. They won 72, but the 70th broke the record, so that makes sense why they would make a shirt.
I mean, there might be some value in the fact that a T-shirt was printed up for beating the Bucks in mid-April randomly.
Yeah, and oddly enough, I can see it. It's a white T-shirt with a 70. It's red.
It's red.
Same concept. Okay. What do you got?
Anyway, yeah, but a white one's going for about $35, but yours might be a little bit more.
Yeah. All right.
Well, where would one sell something like that?
eBay for sure. Do an auction because there probably won't be many to compare that to. Yeah. So start an auction. And don't do buy it now.
Thanks, Kathy.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for calling.
312-981-7200. All right, so I'm going to take a break, come back. We will get the last callers in. We got a good one from Gary. And also, some other stuff coming in. 630 says, I have a pair of underpants signed by Walter Payton.
Nice.
Here we go. See?
Underoos by Kangaroos, right?
Underoos, Kangaroos.
Right.
312-981-7200. And we will also give away that pizza, so stay with us. It's the Swap Meet. Greg Flam is here at DuPage Picker, both on Facebook and Twitter. All right, this is the home stretch. We've got a lot of text, but let me get the callers through. Gary, what do you want to brag about, Gary?
I had two things. I'm going to save the second one for you, Dustin, because you're going to like it. But the first one is I had like a beer tray, you know, the round trays that maybe, you know, waitresses would be serving beer bar. And it's from, I don't know who made it, but it's Indiana University, and it's from 1976. The 1976 NCAA National Champions, Big Ten Champions, 73 through 76, 37 consecutive Big Ten victories. Wow.
What is that worth?
Cannot find it, but I'm going to guess like $25 to $30 at the most.
Hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
I know.
Hopefully more. Do an auction if you do sell it.
For a team that was that dominant in the Big Ten, they get $30?
It's from 1976, and it is in near mint condition.
Gary, you can argue all night. I do the arguing
don't shoot
for
the messenger.
You. I'm always like, that's crazy. I agree with you. It should be more than $30. It should be $250.
Right.
That's what I think. But,
all right, thank you.
Okay, what's
all
your right, other item?
What's the other thing? What do you got?
All right, this is from WGN Radio 720.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Page flyer from 1991. I have it in absolutely mint condition. At the front page says, you're invited to experience the family sports information and community involvement of WGN AM Radio 720, America's most respected radio station. And all eight pages have everybody photos and bios of...
Wow, so it's like a media type.
Yeah, why don't they do that now? I want my photo up in a book that sends to Gary. That's not cool.
Is he like right? Did he write this up?
I mean, that's awesome. Sounds
like
I liked it. America's most respected radio station. We got to bring that back.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
I don't know what that's good, Gary. I like that. I like that a lot. Cool. You have just entered into the top three tonight.
Yep.
I don't know if you.
Still had the Bears at that time too.
Yeah. Right.
And the. They've got photos of everything. Everybody from the sportscasters to the traffic people around here.
Nice.
Everybody.
Everybody's got it. Yeah, and now I can't even get my name on the Twitter handle.
Right. Yeah, you're lucky Ro says your name right now, right?
Ro keeps butchering my name. All right, thanks, Gary. Appreciate it, man.
All right, Dustin.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks, man.
Anything else? Is it worth anything?
That's probably not worth anything, but I think it's the best thing that's been throughout the day.
Yeah, it's a good brag. Yeah. I keep that.
Helen, what do you got? What do you want to brag about, Helen?
I have a commemorative coin. It's a Lewis and Clark $1 gold coin. It's in a set in a little lapel pin, so it's never been circulated.
Okay, and you're sure it's like authentic? Because we're talking big money if it is. Because
this was from my husband's grandfather.
Okay, because
whose name is Clark?
Lewis and Clark.
Right. I mean, there's not many to compare it to. There is one guy asking $18,000 for one, but that's asking.
He's
again,
asking.
So.
What?
That it just means he's asking. Yeah. Some I can go to that guy and go, give me $30. He'll be like, sold.
Right, and you he's can ask $1 million. So
that's a lot of money.
Hey. I thought maybe $1,000.
Yeah, he's obviously up there with the asking price. But I would if you think it's legit, have it graded, take it to a coin dealer. Don't let them buy it from you. Let them maybe grade it and make sure you take it home.
Awesome.
Yeah, I know it is legit. It's been passed down through the generations.
That's
awesome. Thank you for calling.
You definitely got top dollar tonight.
Yeah. Darn it. This is a good week for this stuff.
I'm still going with Superdog.
All right. So that's what I'm breaking it down. I'm going to have Esmeralda. Esmeralda's at her desk. Maybe we can get her to be the one who's going to choose who's going to win the pizza tonight. Esmeralda, are you there?
I am.
All right. Which do you like better? Who should I give a pizza to? A Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. Do I give it to 708, who says, I have a medium-sized, that's my favorite part of this, a medium-sized Super Dog windbreaker from the 80s? And then he says, what's it worth? Just low, because you're like, oh, I don't know if it's all right. Okay. Versus 630, who says, I have a Vanilla Ice t-shirt from a concert in 1991. He not only autographed it, but he also wrote Word to Yo Mother. Pretty sure it's priceless. That's so do you like the windbreaker from Superdog or the Vanilla Ice t-shirt with the autograph Word to Yo Mother?
So it's Yo, Y-O?
Yeah, it's Y-O-M-U-T-H-A.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Classic ice.
Yep.
That is... I like the Vanilla Ice.
Yeah, all right. There you go. It's 630. Greg doesn't like it.
Superdog is great, though.
I know. I know, but I don't
That's
blame
why I went to you. I needed a judge because I couldn't make this choice. So the winner tonight of the pizza is the Vanilla Ice t-shirt signed Word to Yo Mother from Vanilla Ice.
Nice.
Which might get you an extra $20 on that t-shirt
on top
eBay.
Of it, yep.
Greg Flamm is with us every Wednesday night. Thanks to everyone who called in and texted. There were a lot of texts tonight that we didn't get to. We'll get to it next time he's on. We're on spring break next week, but we'll be back the week that the Sox start up, and we'll be moving to that Thursday night. We're going to find places for Greg. That's how we're going to do it around the White Sox, because we know how much Greg and this segment means to the listeners. So we'll find a weekly place for Greg on the lineup. Good to see you, buddy, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.